member of WildGamesProductions.com and D20Radio.com.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the Roll for Initiative podcast. I am your host, DM Vince, along with my faithful host, DM Jason. Jason, how you doing tonight?
Hey, Vince, I'm doing great.
This week, I'll be joined by a special guest host, DM Nick. Nick Blackstone, how are you this week?
I am doing fantastic. How you doing there, Vince?
Super. Nick's going to be sitting in with us this week. And
yeah, it's like, I thought I saw it being all crazy and different, but then she was like, no. Unicycles, I forgot that's not a thing outside of Japan. Insanity rules.
Wow.
You got a bunch of characters, you know, they just lands in their lap. I mean, let the fun begin. So.
So first up, how do you play an evil PC? Is it semi-evil or quasi?
The thing you said right in the middle there, which is that an evil party is going to save a kingdom for greed. Just as well as a good PC does it, you know, because it's the right thing to do.
It's the first day of Gen Con Indianapolis.
Lead him over to the jailer, the jail and bail. So that should be some fun. I'll make sure to record that.
Awesome. All right.
We'll be back tomorrow.
All right.
Okay, the auction's actually over here.
Bastard. Make sure that's in there too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's over this way somewhere.
Yeah, nice and cool. What compared to the sun? but I'm doing fine. Everything's doing okay.
Let's see. Hold on. I saved versus deathmatch. Heat doesn't affect me.
Okay, great. Jason, I save. A girl. We have.
Oh my goodness.
We have the infamous.
I'm doing fine. We've got it hot over here in Seattle for a few days. We can't whine.
How you guys doing? Right now, my weekly gaming group, we're in between role-playing games sessions.
I'm going to just come right out with it. This is going to be my last show as a regular host of Roll for Initiative.
Hey there! She got me into D&D. Actually, it was chainmail.
We're going to leave this week by saying keep it original, keep it old school, and keep your cleric with blunt weapons. Good night, everybody.
Hi, everyone.
Woohoo! Well, guys, I think that's going to put another wrap on the show this week. Or the issue, I should say.
We're having so much fun.
Yeah.
Jason? We're so glad we had this time together.
I knew I was going to start with the singing.
Yeah, well, you know.
The Roll for Initiative podcast, volume number 2, issue 100. I am DM Vince, sitting alongside DM Matt.
Hello, everyone.
DM Nick.
Howdy, everybody.
DM Will.
What's up?
And making a special guest appearance, blast from the past voice, DM Jason.
Wait, what? Where am I? Who are you guys? What am I doing here? I just hold. Wait, what is this? How did I get here?
The podcast. Remember the podcast? Mm-hmm.
Oh, whoa, I've been asleep, man.
Remember?
Did I miss the last 50 shows?
Yeah, kind of.
Something like
that. Whoa, dude.
Yeah.
All right, I'm ready. What are we talking about? What is this?
Well, first of all, we want to jump right into update the contest, because we'll update the contest courtesy of what happened because of the tragedy in the Northeast. Right, well, you update the contest to November 15th is the deadline now.
Yeah, that is correct. 2400, which is 12 midnight for those that are non-military inclined and everything. That's when the contest will officially end. I don't know. How many submissions have we received already?
Is there actually a 2400? Wouldn't that just zero?
No, there's actually 2400.
Wouldn't it just be 2359 and then zero?
Well, I guess there could be, but they say it's 2400.
I think we better
have 0000.
Yeah, my VCR disagrees.
Anyway, yeah, so it's due to the tragedy, a couple people in the Northeast area asked if we can extend the time for a few days, and we will.
We are more than
willing.
So,
Will, what time is it when it's 1 minute past 2400?
0000. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's see. 1 minute at 0100. No, 0001. You're
going
to mess me all up. All right, leave me alone. 0001.
I like this new show. So what's the contest?
The contest is to win a copy of set 3 original reprints of the ones that Wizards of the Coast put out, the 3 books.
Keeping my mouth shut.
They were supposed to design a module based on his parameters and send it in.
All right.
And we have 7 submissions total.
And okay, good. Enjoy those books.
I know. I'm enjoying all 6 sets of mine.
6.
Oh, they're bad. Oh, they're bad.
Well, I didn't buy them either, so.
I returned them, actually. I bought them. I have one because I had to keep it because I opened it. And I took a look at the typography and I just went, who did this? And I returned the others.
It looked too big to me when I first opened it, too.
They tried to approximate the font. They didn't get it right. The kerning's off. It's too thin. It's so clearly, I mean, just not correct. They used the wrong kind of paper. The whole thing is like somebody who read about this and heard about it but had never actually seen the original book, and they got as close as they could in the dark. Yeah.
Well, so much for the contest.
Jason. Yeah, I'm just gonna take it back then. I'm just gonna take this door and get my money back, and then you all can find some other prize for these people and everything. The books are fine. I think they did the right thing. They're reintroducing D&D. They couldn't get it right all on the board, but guess what? I can read it and it works just fine.
You know, you should try 4th edition.
I'm surprised we even said that on here.
Yeah, what is this 4th edition you speak of?
You mean that tabletop game?
Yes, no, I mean 4th edition Packmaster.
Oh. Okay.
Anyway, sorry, I'm not trying to sabotage things. I'm here for real. Now let's really do the show.
Since you can't shut up, Jason, why don't we just jump to you and see what have you been up to in the last 50 episodes? What have you been doing?
Well, the lights have been out for a few days, so that's what I've been doing lately. Yeah, I've been off kind of working on this project that's been in the works for a little while now. And we're almost done. So what I can say right now is that it's a new gaming company, but it's starting out as with our first product is just going to be a magazine, printed magazine that you can actually hold in your hands. We've got a real all-star cast that I'm going to kind of keep quiet about until it's actually out because I think it's more fun to be surprised. Ooh. But I can tell you that it'll be a good surprise, I hope.
Can I speculate?
I'd rather accidentally reveal anything. If you don't mind. Okay. But it'll be in both print as well as iPad or PDF versions. So
awesome.
Either one. And if everything goes well with it, if people like the magazine and if they're enjoying it, then we'll be publishing a few little kind of game products over the next year. And hopefully turning it into something kind of bigger by this time, by Christmas 2013. So that's basically what I want to say at this point.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it's a project you've been working in the works. Okay.
Yeah, it'll be neat. I'm hoping to get everything finished up so that this magazine will be ready for people to get for Christmas. If it is, which I'd say is about 90% likely, there will be some little Christmas packages that will be available with some cool swag in them, not just the magazines. You can actually give it as a gift to somebody.
Oh, cool.
But I'll tell you one thing if anybody's listening wants to help out with. The reason it's not quite out is because there's still a few pieces that haven't been illustrated yet. And surprisingly, that's one of the harder things to get is good artists.
Well, where can they contact you if they want to apply, so for instance?
I would say get a hold of me on Twitter would probably be the best thing to do. My Twitter name is just Jason Elliott, JaysonElliott. Here's the thing, though. There's an editorial policy with the magazine, as there will be with our products afterwards. We do not accept digital artwork. So if you draw on the computer or you color it on the computer, we don't want it. We're only working with traditional artists, whether that's oils, acrylics, watercolors, markers, charcoal, Conte, whatever you work with.
Crayons?
Yes, Conte crayons, definitely.
Sweet. Picture pages, time to do the picture pages.
What if I call it in blood? Is that acceptable?
This isn't the Kiss comic book that came out in the 70s.
Bring back, you know, some of the more traditional art styles that are a little bit harder to do. So it means that of the artists that are out there, only about 10% of them are working in this. And so I'm trying to find really the best ones.
Oh, wow. I didn't know it was that difficult.
Well, you know, it's really easy to sit down and just work with a Wacom tablet or, you know, just do something like that on the computer. And most of the stuff that you see now is done that way. And it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing wrong with it. That's fine for what it's for. But we want to have something that's got a little bit more of an artistic depth to it.
A little more organic feel to it, too, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's funny. Like, one of the comics – so the magazine will have comics because you can't do a gaming magazine without comics, right?
Right.
Right. Yeah.
One of the comics first came in colored digitally, and so we had to redo that. And after redoing it, it was funny. You could look at the two and the same coloring and everything, but it's just those little happy accidents and what happens when you've got the human touch on something and the lens that you can do with traditional media that you just can't do with – well, I suppose if you worked really hard, you could do it with a computer, but they don't normally happen.
Work really hard to have imperfections. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Why not just, you know, do it by hand? Because it's great. You know, when you're working by hand, you see, oh, man, I screwed that up. But then you realize that it leads you to another place.
Mm, very true.
Very true. Anyway, if there's any artists out there that are traditional, that work in traditional media and do fantasy art and would like to contact me about putting some things in, get a hold of me. And like I said, Twitter is a good way to do that.
Elmore.
How about an
email? Otis. Errolis. Excuse me.
How about an email address, Jason, just in case they don't use Twitter?
Maybe they could just, like, contact through the show or something. I don't really want to –
I think Jason at RFIpodcast.com still exists.
Then let's hook that back up. Yeah, that'd be a great way to get a hold of me.
So Jason at RFIpodcast.com is his – you can contact him through that. And she'll go directly to his private email address.
I'll make sure that's working.
Okay. Anyway, so enough about Jason. He's hogged up enough time. Nick, how's your face-to-face game going?
Great. We had a fantastic turnout last time. It was a couple weeks ago now. And I was really impressed. It was our first real game that my friend Jeff got into since he got back from Afghanistan.
Right.
We're doing the Hackmaster version of Temple of Elemental Evil, the Temple of Existential Evil. And yeah, we got back in that campaign. We had, oh my gosh, and we had a special guest show up. Our buddy Dwarf, who used to work for Cancer Co., and he drove out from Madison, Wisconsin, or Racine, I'm sorry, Racine, and drove out for that weekend and gamed with us. So that was a real treat. So we had a real good time that night. And yeah, our next one's coming up, and it's our November game, where our traditional potluck that we'll do. So that's always really fun. So everybody brings something to eat.
Is he still doing the game with the kids, or is that on hold?
Yes. Yeah, actually, that's still going on. And in fact, our next game will be in about 2 weeks from now.
Okay.
So, yeah, the game, and we're doing the regular Temple of Elemental Evil on that one. So, I'm really well versed in that whole module. I'm learning that thing backwards and forwards. So, those guys are really enjoying it too. So,
cool.
Yeah, it's going great.
My face-to-face game is going pretty well. I'm actually DMing next week because the actual DM is out of town, and he told me to take over for 1 week. So I'm going to kill the group. I mean, play with the group. You know, make sure. And hopefully they'll have fun. Book of Sorrows campaign is... Remember that campaign I started a long time ago, Jason? Book of Sorrows?
Yeah.
It's still going on.
Awesome.
And it's actually on hiatus right now due to... I have some family issues I have to take care of during the week, so...
What's the survival rate in the game?
I think... Let's see, one, two... We've killed off four people total.
Out of three?
How do you do that? That's amazing.
Now, we've had quite a bit of people come in and out of the game, so... Mm. Anyway, so that game's on hiatus for right now, the people that keep asking about it, so... I apologize. It'll be back soon. Let's see. Will, what have you been doing?
Well, I mean, I still run my games as I normally do. Besides that, that's about pretty much all I've been doing and everything. This Call of Cthulhu thing is actually going pretty well.
Oh, so, you're doing a Call of Cthulhu game?
I have been for the last 2 years. Ever since really? I retired out of the military. Yeah, I started in November of 2010. I got four groups that I run right now.
Oh my God, where the heck have I been?
Well, no, you know about
everything. Not playing Call of Cthulhu with Will. That's
apparently not.
So, no, I've run a Call of Cthulhu game. I've run a two Pathfinder games, and I'm running a first edition group.
Sweet.
Is the Call of Cthulhu game, is that face-to-face or is that over Skype or something?
All my games are face-to-face. Okay. The only one that's not is the one game that's run by Dwayne on Monday evenings. But no, I prefer my games to be face-to-face because when I kill them, I want to see what they look like.
Wow. Are you doing classic, like, 20s or are you doing...
The 1920s. I prefer the 1920s. But cool. Once we complete the mask and Athalatep and everything and all that...
Oh, yeah.
We are going to do a whole new set of characters, and then we're going to the 1860s, 1870s.
Oh, wow. Kind of, what are you going to do, like a Wild West kind of thing?
Oh, no, actually not. We're going to England. We're going to start with England and then, you know, work with Scotland because there's a lot of Cthulhu mythos activity in those two regions during that time period.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, that'll take him to Egypt and just move. You know, I'm not sure be saying all this stuff because I'm telling my players what I'm doing, but they're good now. Yeah, so no, it's going to be pretty interesting and everything because there's a lot of new Call of Cthulhu stuff being released these days and everything. So I'm looking forward to it. Yep.
I'm still kind of wary about the 7th edition that's coming out. But hey, it's all other editions have been backward compatible with their stuff, so I'm not gonna worry about it.
Yeah, well, you know, I saw what their 7th edition, you know, release notes and everything, and it doesn't look like they're going to change it that much and everything. It needs a little bit of a facelift, and we all know that Chaosium is... There's some issues going on there. They're having some issues. Yeah. So they have to do something to try and, you know, get some spirit out there, you know, liven it up a little bit. Now, I don't know if it's going to help any. I don't know how it's going to affect the fan base and everything. As far as I said, I will try it. If not, if it doesn't work out for 7th edition, I still got 6.
Yeah, that's the one I got, that 25th anniversary edition.
Oh, yeah, nice book.
Yeah, very nice book. I really enjoy that. I did a one-shot like a couple of years ago. I did that one adventure, The Haunting, but, you know, I've been dying to try to get a campaign going. It's just, you know, not everybody's hip to it. We're just... You know, we're stuck with the dungeon crawls, which is fine. I mean, I enjoy it, but I just kind of like to mix it up once in a while, too.
Right. Well, I did for the last 3 weeks, I was doing Blood Brothers, and I think some of y'all know about Blood Brothers.
Yeah, I got both books. Those are great.
Yeah, and so what I did was I did a Jason Voorhees kind of story thing.
Awesome.
They were all teenagers and everything, just for 3 weeks, because it's October, and we'd like to do that Halloween scary thing and everything. And, it ended up being that the really bad guy was the spirit of the mom, and it was the mom that killed him instead of Jason. Yeah, because, see, I fooled him to think that, you know, Jason was the bad guy, but Jason actually was kind of sympathetic with the doggone, you know, the people and everything, and so he was trying to help them, but they kept attacking him, thinking he was the bad guy, but instead it was the spirit of the mother who maintained some type of, you know, residual force there and everything as a ghost, and ended up killing them all. So it was all good. They had all the clues in the world. They had that mentality. It's Jason. He's trying to kill us.
Oh yeah. I mean, a guy with a hockey mask on and machete coming towards me. I'm not sure if he's going to help me or not. Call me crazy.
But it worked out perfect.
If you might be in a case where you're in the jungle, you have to get through a bunch of stuff, and you're playing hockey, in which case you want to see exactly that.
No, it worked out great. We had a good time and everything, and they learned their lesson and everything. And next year, for October, we have decided that we're going to do all chill in the month of October next year.
Oh, that would be nice too.
Yep.
Cool. And Matt, what have you been up to?
Well, my group decided that waiting till August for Gen Con would just be too long of a period to have a crazy weekend of gaming. So this weekend we decided that we would go and just rent a cabin and game all weekend and have our own little personal gaming convention. So we had Cabin Con 2012, me and my group. We loaded up with all the board games we could think of. Well, not all of them because we own way too many, but we piled a bunch into our cars, rented a cabin at a local park, and just gamed all weekend. Played some Ticket to Ride, the new X-Wings miniature game, some Starfleet Commander. We played a game of Munchkin Blender with like four different Munchkin sets with like eight people. That was insane. And one player got so tired of Munchkin, he started helping someone else to win. Just because he wanted it over with.
Yeah, that game is just horrendously. Ugh.
Yeah, especially when you have four different sets of different Munchkin sets involved.
You were playing like zombies and regular and top secret and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, we had the regular Munchkin, Munchkin Cthulhu, Super Munchkin.
Cthulhu would have to be in there.
And Munchkin Impossible with the Munchkin.
Munchkin Impossible, that's what it's called.
Yeah, so we had all four of those at the same time, and it was just ridiculous. And yeah, one of the players got tired, so we're like, he started help. We're like, what are you doing? You're going to help him? I know. I want this game to end.
Now, you said you played Starfleet Commander?
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah, there's a new edition of streamlined version of Starfleet Commander. There's like three or four of us that are like big war gamers. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, so we played that, and that was like our big Ameritrash game for the weekend. We just played a little skirmish between the Klingons and the Federation that the Klingons won. It was me.
Yay.
And, yes, and it was me.
How did you like X-Wing?
Oh, we love it. We love it. We actually had the same, me and two other people, we actually just maintained the same teams in both games. So it was me.
Who was Porkins?
They don't have, unfortunately, there is no Porkins yet, but we took out Biggs, Garvin, and I forget what the other pilot we used, but the Imperials won in X-Wing twice.
Wow. You didn't have Luke Skywalker with R2-D2?
Nope. That's what happens that's what happens when you let the Imperial players pick the ships for the Rebels. Yeah, because I was on the Imperial side, and while they
gets Z-95 headhunters, huh?
Yeah, we gave them two X-Wings and a Y-Wing, and we gave them some pilots, and we built ours up, and we also had some ridiculous dice rolls. We would roll three dice and have like three critical hits.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the whole thing about it. You can have good tactics there, but if you're rolling like that, yeah, the game's going to be over.
We just rolled hot twice in a row. And then after we defeated them twice in games of X-Wing, we decided to play the old 3M Challenge at Pebble Beach Golf. And we called this a charity golf outing between the Rebels and the Imperials for an Alderaan charity, at which point the Rebels won the golf tournament.
Okay.
They're good at golf, but terrible at X-Wing fighter.
Yes.
Well, go figure.
Well, the good thing is, though, in December, that's when the Falcon, the Slave One, the A-Wing, and the Advanced TIE Interceptor come out, right. So you'll have some more ships.
Yeah. We already have plans to buy them. I think one of them already has some on pre-order, and yeah, we are more than prepared to get that. We had like two different sets of the game, too, so we had plenty of ships.
Excellent, excellent.
Yes, it was good times.
Porkins, what an unfortunate name.
Yeah.
Well, I was hoping he was going to be in there because I want to kill him. That's my main goal in that game is every time someone plays Porkins, I want to kill him.
I want a Lieutenant Ketch pilot, the stuffed Ewok pilot they used in one of the Wrath Squadron books. It was back with the Wrath Squadron tried to...
I want a TIE fighter pilot who's a Jawa.
Yeah, That's actually what they did. They had Wedge like cram into a TIE fighter and stick this plush Ewok on top of him, and Wedge was piloting it, hiding in this Ewok, stuffed Ewok was in it, so when they would be doing battle and they'd look over inside, they would see an Ewok, and the Imperials would be like, oh no, this Ewok escaped from our evil, they had some like scientific lab where they were doing experiments on like non-human races, and like they were creating like super genius Gamorreans and things like that.
Ewok with three buttocks, that's real super genius stuff.
Yeah. So I want a stuffed Ewok pilot. And the rest of like the Wrath and Rogue Squadron pilots from the books.
I think for any Star Wars game that you play from now on, you have to base them all around trying to predict the plot of the next Star Wars film.
Which is the big news this past week about Lucasfilm.
All right, hands up. How many people are excited and how many people are upset?
I'm excited about
I'm excited.
I'm on the fence. I don't know what to think right now.
Will?
I never had a problem with George Lucas from day one. I have never had a problem with him.
So what do you think about the new ones? Are you excited or do you think
we're just going to have to see what happens there. Well, nothing was ruined from the get-go. I don't think anything was ever ruined. I think that Disney is a better choice than anywhere else if it came down to it, to be honest. I don't think anyone else can.
And they've been having such a long working relationship right now, what, 15 years at least?
Disney has it all. I mean, look how they're doing DC. I mean, and look how they don't they own the Muppets.
Yeah, look what they did with the Marvel franchise when they acquired it 3 years ago. I mean, look what the Avengers film.
You're totally right. Disney is a good caretaker, and it'll get us new Star Wars films.
Oh
right.
Heck yeah!
Right.
You know, so I think it's going to be great. Although
I brought this up though. Think about it though. What this might not be so far fetched. You know, officially pairing up with Disney is. You know, a whole theme park, Star Wars theme park. Think about it.
Yeah. Is that so far?
Yeah, sure. I don't think that's so far fetched. I would love that.
In Vegas a few years ago, they had a thing called the Star Trek Experience. It was
I remember going to see that.
It was great, right?
It was fun.
Would you not like to see something like that for Star Wars, only expanded to a whole park?
Oh my God! Actually, sitting down at lunch at Mos Eisley Cantina would be so cool.
Exactly. You could have like a training room where you get to fight the training orb. You could have all sorts of things where you could try to actually, you know, recreate things from the movies. I would love that. Totally fun.
Yeah, that'd be so wicked.
Yeah. So all for that. Although I was so a friend of mine works at Pixar, so I was over there while I was out in California just visiting them. And they were doing their Halloween party, and one guy came as Darth Vader with the mouse ears.
Awesome.
And apparently, secondhand, I wasn't there to know this, but apparently, like, a ton of people at Lucasfilm the day after the announcement actually came to work in mouse ears.
Really?
So, that's fun.
I wonder if they're going to continue with the live-action TV show they had planned.
They said there is a television series that's going to happen.
Cool.
As long as it's the Christmas special. That's all that matters.
I'm not saying that.
Harvey Korman and special music guest star Jefferson Starship.
I like the holiday special.
Good for you.
You're the only one.
Special?
But then I have very bad taste and I enjoyed the wacky because I want the 2D fighting game. Marvel versus Star Wars versus Disney princesses. I want that video game. That would be amazing.
Special brony bonus level.
Yes, my love. Yes, because friendship is magic.
And special guest appearance by Jersey Shore.
So, are you guys, Vince, were you serious when you were telling me that you're going to be changing the Roll for Initiative podcast to all brony from now on?
That was actually in the works, and it fell through.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
I'm sorry, Jason.
Next time.
Yeah, maybe.
You didn't have enough money for the My Little Pony franchise.
Yeah, unfortunately.
No one could come up with the $1.95. I can't understand it.
Yeah. Let's head into some sage advice.
Sage advice.
Sage advice.
We're going to have some sage advice. Hey.
Yeah. That was for you, Jason. No comp.
He's died.
Okay, I turned my volume back on. Are you guys ready?
Anyway, we have two voicemails that came in, and actually I have a question that one of the players in my group actually asked, but we'll do the voicemail first because those are people that called in first. So here we go.
Hi, this is Adam from Illinois. I'm calling with a question that I asked the Seiko Hammer guys a few months back, and I asked them why second edition, and they said that basically that second edition is first edition only better organized. And I was wanting to know, like, you know, why you guys prefer first edition over second edition. Do you agree with what they're saying there, or do you have any other ideas on that subject? So you guys do a great show, keep up the great work, and thanks for taking my call. Bye.
Can I throw in, I mean, I think there's one thing fundamentally that needs to be pointed out right at the beginning is the reason that second edition even existed in the first place.
Go ahead.
You know, which was, there was no overwhelming need for it at the moment. There wasn't somebody saying, you know, first edition is a mess, we can't figure out how to play it, the rules are wrong. What there was a copyright problem.
Yeah.
TSR wanted to get rid of any obligation they had to give Gary Gygax money for the work that he had done. And so I think second edition is one of those things where it's got a lot of good stuff in it, but it's basically just, it is still first edition. The main difference I see is that the artwork is unbelievably bad, and that there's a lot of splat books that, you know, can be fun to look at, but it just, they hurt my eyes, so that's why I don't use them. That's it.
Yeah, Jason pretty much echoed my sentiments. I mean, my sentiments exactly.
Yes. Okay, Sandy, go on.
Some of the splat books were okay. I mean, the core ones, I guess, were fine. But why first edition over any other? Well, I guess part of it is, well, nostalgia. I mean, I'm not going to deny that at all, that there's a certain nostalgic feel for myself when I play first edition. It's what I think I know the best. And I think that has one that has the most fun material for me to use. Well, so that's why for me.
Yeah, I never really liked second edition. Artwork horrible, names changing, and anything to do to get away from Gary. So the hell with
I like having my demons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to say it like this. First and second edition, two different games, too many fundamental differences, too many rule variations, the rule mechanics changed, there were demons and devils, they went by a different name. I mean, I didn't care if they called it, what do they call them again?
Beatsu and Tanari.
I mean, big deal. They're still demons and devils. I mean, all you had to do was say demon and devil. You didn't have to call it a Tanari. I didn't, you know, the artwork, art is subjective. I mean, art is just art. I mean, either you like it or you don't. I didn't like half the art in first edition, and I didn't like half the art in, you know, second edition.
Well, but, I mean, it's not entirely subjective because whatever I say about it is correct.
Oh, really?
Oh, here we go.
Okay, I can tell you this right now. I just see I see floating turds everywhere right now. You're just picking them out of the sky.
Oh,
that's odd. I have no idea what's going on in your room right now, but that sounds like you should fix it.
Finish.
I have a real question, though, Will. I mean, give me some of a breakdown, because I don't really play second edition, although I've been in second edition games, and they felt so similar to first that it didn't really bother me. What do you see as the fundamental rule differences?
Oh, well, definitely in the classes and everything. I mean, you have priestly spheres. I mean, we can go on all day about this, but it's just better for me just to go onto the forum and just be a member of the forum and everything, and I would gladly post a listing of the fundamental differences between first edition and second edition. It's quite a few, quite a few.
So, essentially, I mean, everybody's game gets house ruled to some extent. Well, not everybody's, but a lot of people's. And so the way I've always looked at it is you've got two different ways you can play a D&D-like game. You can play old school or new school, and it really kind of breaks down between second and third edition. Yeah. And there's a lot of games that have that – that's not even fair for me to say 3.5 really. there's a lot of games that have that 3.5 and later approach that Pathfinder and 4E and all these others take that is influenced by video games and cartoons and that kind of thing. And then there's those that are influenced by war games and older literary things, which is your old school approach. And whatever you're playing in that old school world of first or second edition and games inspired by them, you could house rule it to the point that you might not be able to tell the difference. But you cannot house rule first or second edition into, say, fourth.
No.
So I kind of just
really
see a
could,
between
no.
them.
But one of the things I actually like about second edition is the rules didn't so much diverge from first to where – for the most part, first edition adventures were completely compatible with second.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of the big things. It was, using a term, backward compatible with first.
Right.
You
right.
could take right. you could take adventures like the Slave Lord series and plunk them right into second edition rules with really no problem
right.
at all.
It's I'm actually doing that in my home game right now. I'm running a Ravenloft campaign in first edition, but I'm taking some of the second edition modules, stealing things from those, and
right.
running them in first, and it's not hard at all. If it's a monster, I just use the first edition equivalent of it.
In fact, if I remember correctly, for Temple of Elemental Evil, mm-hmm. its final print one run went into like 1990 or 1991 or something like that. It was well into second edition before they stopped printing Temple of Elemental Evil.
Yeah. Yeah. Like so, I don't know what a priestly sphere is, but I'm sure that
it's like
the
Schools of Magic.
You,
they did Schools of
yeah.
Magic for priests.
Oh. Okay, well, then that's all right. I mean, then you could really, if you wanted to go to first edition and take some of the stuff, you could choose to ignore some specific things about it.
Right.
You know, so if you play super by the book, I can see that you'd say these two things are incompatible. But most people I know house rule things yeah. on purpose or accidentally anyways.
Yeah.
Well, no, see, now, let me clarify one thing. One, I didn't say nothing about compatibility. I never said compatibility one time in my sentence. I'm
okay.
just stating that there are fundamental differences, and they are vast differences. For example, just like Vince says, and, you know, clerics can't use I can't use edge weapons in first edition. No, of course, we found a
well,
rule
talk
where it
to,
says,
talk to Nick about that.
Well, yeah, I know. But in second edition now, guess what? They can use edge weapons, depending on the DM.
By their god.
But so, like I said, psionics
that's
was a big
a
difference.
Difference, though. That's not fundamental.
Oh, there are some fundamental differences, and so did psionics. Psionics was a fundamental difference. Hit dice, creature
optional
abilities,
rule.
Monster
yeah.
manuals.
Yeah.
I mean,
THACO yes. is different because in second edition it's a linear math, whereas it's a chart in first edition. The math is not identical. I mean, from the 20,000-foot view, they're very similar games. You really can't tell them apart. As you get closer, you start finding all these little differences that
right.
make a first edition magic user different than a second edition wizard. And you can go through each classes. They're all slightly different.
So to go to the caller's question, if we basically, I think we all agree that there are differences between first and second edition that you can either, you know, choose to pay attention to or ignore. But if you're going by the book and by the rules, the purpose of preferring the first edition hit tables or the first edition approach to clerical weapons or not having spheres of magic, what do you think? Why do you like that better than the second?
Well, it's just, I guess, a matter of personal preference.
I like first edition. It gives you more room to make up your own calling or rulings, I should say.
Yeah, instead of rules, it's more about rulings in first edition.
It's also not.
It's actually not. And here's the thing: a bit of insight that I've only kind of come by recently, because I've always wondered why it was that you had this first edition approach before the books came out, before the DMG and everything was out. You had this really, like you say, rulings instead of rules or whatever. You know, it was a lot more loose. What the Dungeon Master's Guide and the Player's Handbook were really for was tournament play.
Right, we know
that. Oh, yeah, that's true.
You know, and it's something I didn't really think about it this way until recently. So if you want to look at those books as sets of rules, there is no room for interpretation. You do it the way it says.
That's
if you're in a tournament.
In a tournament, yeah, but Gary specifically says in the book, adjust the rules to your liking, so. Mm-hmm.
Well, you could put that line in second edition then if you wanted to.
Well, Gary didn't write second edition, so.
Come down to why do you like first over second? I mean, for myself, I would say that you can take – if you like some rules or the way things are organized in second, I don't see any problem with that. And I think it would be very easy for somebody from either table to sit down at the other table and get into it quickly. My reason for liking the first is because I think the artwork's better in the sense that – not in that, you know, somebody – made a more artistic, talented version of it, but the same reason that I'm going to prefer to listen to 70s punk over like some kind of 90s Green Day crap, you know, because I like something that's more raw and that's a little bit more human. And the first stuff felt less polished, and that's something I appreciate.
Well, not everybody could be an American Idiot, so.
I don't even know what that means.
Green Day song.
No, I know what it means, but I'm just trying to be pretentious.
Oh. Anyway, first edition, the superior edition, as I like to quote now.
Hipster edition.
But second edition to me is when I believe was when power gaming and munchkinism was perfected with all the splat books and all the different little paths that people can pick. And everybody, I mean, munchkinism was in every edition, but I think it was perfected in second edition.
No. Later, a very later edition made it an exact science. It expected you to
Vince is
power
right in the sense that that's where munchkinism really took hold. Yeah. I don't know if perfected, but it really became institutionalized.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's when it was really introduced, and you had the ability to min max to your heart's content.
I mean, I recall being in there was a gaming club locally where I grew up, and there was this one guy that going on with the whole munchkinism thing. Every single character that he had was like split class or multi-classed with ninja. You name it, it was I'm serious, he was fighter slash ninja or magic user slash ninja.
Awesome. Was he ever a bard slash ninja?
Maybe. I don't know, but he had the most broken flipping characters I've ever seen. It was like munchkinism because, he would, you would like, where'd you get these unbelievable stats and whatever? And at that time, the point I'm making is like, for the most part, he was shunned because he had all these outrageously characters on, the character sheets. It's like, really? you have that many 18s or more? I mean, how that
wasn't the DM around to, see what he was doing?
Well, that's kind of questionable in itself. But the point is, then it's like when people did stuff like that in the past, they were, for the most part, shunned.
Right.
Because they were seeing that they were doing something that was wasn't right. And later on, that sort of mentality that you were going to make like the uber bad character that has like great ability scores and can do this, that, and the other thing with and at first level, I mean, that became like Matt was saying, over time that became the accepted thing,
right?
And
yeah, it's like with first edition, it was intended for tournament play, but the concept of winning at D&D didn't really start happening until second edition in people's home games. That's when you really had the options to, if I combine this dragon article with this splat book and this player's option book, I get this broke-tastic character. And then,
do you think that's why the caller likes second edition, though? It sounds like the caller just likes the way that second edition is organized.
Well, from an organizational standpoint, they actually probably – they did have like better indexing. And when it comes to flipping to things, it's in logical spots.
Oh, I'll tell you, the DMG is a mess.
Right. Yeah.
Which is why I like it, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it really depends on the type of – some players like 4th edition, the players that really like it play Magic the Gathering a lot because that type of construction, it appeals to them, that type of – being highly optimized and efficient in building something really appeals to them. And I think the same goes for people that may enjoy second over first because they enjoy that building, that construction, that optimization. Because when creating a character for first, really, you can create one in like 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Second edition, you can make one that quick. Or if you want, you can take 2-3 hours by piling through splat books. So I think it's just the type of gamer you are. If you are you there more for the story, or are you there more for the gaming with storytelling?
Man, I got to find this article. Maybe I can find it before we finish this show. I just was randomly flipping through Dragons like I do sometime, and there was a great article by Gary. Oh, you know what it was? I picked it up at a store the other day. It was an issue I didn't have. And there was an issue by Gary Gygax that was all talking about how to – let's take the story out and put more action in. It was actually specifically saying people have gotten too much into turning it into an improv acting class.
Yeah.
Oh.
I got to find it. Keep talking. Right. I'll be right back.
Yeah. Well, the thing with that is –
he just walks away.
Yeah. The thing with that is, though – if you're good, you can tell a story through action. There is an art to telling a story through combat.
Yes. Yeah, I know.
If you look at any fight scene or a movie, there's a typical pattern that's followed. First, something happens to where it gives you a reason to root for the good guy. Good guy beats up bad guy. Good guy's better than bad guy or whatever. Good guy's doing something that you at home want to see happen. So, yay, you're cheering for good guy. Then bad guy does something to good guy, and now bad guy's got the advantage, and the good guy's in an underdog situation. And then throughout the course of that combat, good guy gets his shots. It looks like he's going to come back. Bad guy stops him. You just repeat that a few times to build up the suspense. And then, boom, something major happens. Good guy takes over, and you go to your climax.
Stop describing John Cena's life, okay?
Oh, do you want me to explain that again in full Carney terms? I can.
I found what it was. If you guys are interested, the article's called Realms of Role Playing, Let's Start Pushing the Pendulum the Other Way by Gary Gygax, October 85, issue 102. And I'm not going to read from it, but basically he's just saying that there was a long – I'll read the very first sentence. There was a long period of time when action rather than role playing was the major focus of gaming, and this was especially true with respect to tournament scenarios at conventions. Now the pendulum has swung the other way. Too much emphasis is being placed on how well the player takes on the role of his or her character. And he starts kind of going into basically why he felt that action should start coming back.
Right.
So worth a read if you have a chance.
Yeah, I guess it makes – it makes sense.
He probably denied what he said later or something.
Well, considering he's a war gamer, it started as a war game. It was a war game with storytelling at first. Now it evolved into a storytelling game with some wargaming aspects. And it depends on which variant you were looking for. And at that point in time, he probably thought, well, this is more of a war game with storytelling that's evolved into a storytelling game with some wargaming, and he wanted to swing the pendulum back in the other direction.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly. So.
I like a balance of both. What can I say?
Yeah, more of a story.
Good voicemail. Good question.
Definitely. Okay, let's go on to our second voicemail of the night.
Hi, guys. This is DM Kojo. I just want to say I'm eagerly anticipating the 100th issue of RFI. I can't wait to see what you guys got cooked up for that supersized issue. I have a question here specifically about a combat maneuver that some people I've heard refer to as sweeping. On page 25 of the player's handbook, it talks about there's a chart of fighters, paladins, rangers attacks per melee round, and how as they go up in level, they get more attacks per round. Then there's a note at the bottom that says it excludes melee combat with monsters of less than one hit die and non-exceptional humans. In those cases, it says that a fighter can attack once for each of his or her experience levels. So I interpret that as any monster with a 1-1 hit die or less, like goblins, which are 1-7 hit points, the monster manual, kobolds, 1-4, your rat, centipedes, those types of things, small, low hit dice or hit point monsters. I assume then qualify for this, but I've never used this. I've never heard of anybody using it. In fact, I didn't even know about it until it was recently called to my attention on the forums. So just curious if you guys use this rule, how does it come into play in your combat? Love to hear what you have to say on it. Thanks. You have great work. See ya.
Okay, so we're going to page 25 after, Kojo asked. And we're looking at the little blurb at the very, very bottom below the fighters, paladins, and rangers attacks per melee round table. Everybody sees it?
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah.
I've never actually used this rule.
Holy cow, that puts a whole new dimension on fighter types, don't it?
Yeah.
Not really. I mean, it's just for saying that if you're fighting something that's lousy at fighting back, just go ahead and start hitting it once for every experience level you've got. If you've got a really high-level fighter type trying to take on some little, you know, farmer, then bam, 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 he's dead.
Well, I'm just saying, like, what if, like, if he had, like, a whole bunch of kobolds and your fighter was there, let's say he was 7th level, would that entitle that 7th level fighter to have one attack per kobold or 7 attacks on one?
7 attacks on one. That's the way I would rule it. I mean, I'm just taking this from what... The reasoning to me is that he's fighting a creature that's so lousy at fighting back against him that he can just get a lot of attacks in on him. Trying to turn it into then going to the next one, then going to the next one, then going to the next one would be a different kind of rationale to me.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I mean, just in order to keep the game from being... Well, first of all, how often are you likely going to throw... a bunch of kobolds against an 8th level fighter.
Right. Well, that would even apply at a 2nd level, though.
Yeah, this kind of reminds me of that 4th edition rule of the minions with the one hit point.
Right.
Doesn't it really remind you of that?
Yeah, it does.
It does. You're right.
I wonder if they pulled that out of this and decided to make that rule up. Hmm.
Well, so let's all start using the rule now.
Yeah.
Will, do you use this rule?
Oh, yes, I play by the book. However,
so you always use this rule.
Yes, and this is one of the reasons. Now, I want you to understand this. Now, listen to me carefully now.
Okay.
Because I tell all these other people online.
Really?
No, 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 no. What happened was is I have made a comment on there, and I have done this over the years, ever since I was playing first. I understand. I started with 1974, so I'm one of the old school grognards, I guess they call them now. But anyway... When I was playing first edition, yeah, it got really tiring. There's no reason why you can't have a 5th level orc fighter or a 5th level kobold fighter. It just didn't make no doggone sense. So this rule was rarely, rarely used because I had never allowed, you know, a 7th or 8th level fighter, as yours, an example, to run into like 30, 40 kobolds and like, hey, I can have 7 attacks on one kobold. And a 7th level fighter probably get, you know, outnumbered and killed anyway. But no, I usually had as the characters advanced the levels, there was chances they would run into monsters that were, you know, halfway, you know, close to them or so a little bit challenging, whatever the case may be.
So you'd bulk up your monsters, is what you're saying.
Well, I won't say I bulk them up, even though there's really no official rules concerning the use of monsters and hit die in classes. I'm just saying that there's no reason why they cannot exist. So I'm not saying, well, if I have a party of 7th level characters, let's take them, they're going into the Giant series, I don't think there was any kobolds in there. Or goblins or anything of that nature. You know what I'm saying? So I put it in that sense. I make sense where monsters make sense. A 7th level fighter is not going to run into one hit die kobolds. Well, they're not even one hit die. What aren't they a half?
Yeah.
So since you've been playing with the rule, you've been using this rule about multiple attacks based on your experience level.
Yes.
If you have a 7th level fighter come up against a group of half hit die creatures. Do you allow them to take one hit on each creature, or do you restrict it?
One foe.
Okay. So it's still one attack.
So we got 2 votes for the one foe.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is not really, you know, similar or analogous to cleave. You know, it's not very split. When you read this, it only says, all these creatures the title fight attack once for each of his or her experience levels. It doesn't say per foe.
That's
so I'm
true.
Assuming this is only one creature.
Yeah. So like a 5th level ranger keep on using the Cobalt, he would have up to 5 attacks on that one Cobalt.
Right. That is correct.
Yeah. Or that one Goblin.
That's what the rule says.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I would rule it as the one creature as well. You're not going to get your 5 attacks against 5 different goblins. You're going to get them against one goblin.
Okay.
All 5. And yeah, when you think about
it, doesn't specify the difference in here, but I think it makes more sense the way that you're saying it.
Right. And also when you look at the number typically appearing for those type of creatures, it's usually some number like 40. Now we can understand why you'll run into 30 or 40 of them appearing in like a random encounter.
Yeah.
Because you're getting 3-4 attacks per creature.
Right.
So that horde isn't quite as scary.
Yeah, it makes a lot more sense now.
It does now. It does.
Oh, glad that Kojo pointed that out because I didn't even know about
it. Thank you, DM Kojo. That helps to read those little asterisk areas, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. I'll skip over them.
You know what? I'm going to start using that rule my next game. You know? That makes sense.
Must be because we're old and it was small print and stuff like that.
Yeah, I can't read that small.
Two glasses on, Nick, right?
I lost my glasses like months ago. Oh.
I can see where Cleave comes in this port, though. I can see where Cleave could come in.
There's no rule on Cleave, what?
No. I'm talking about, you know, where Pathfinder 3.5 is concerned. I can see how where Cleave can come in this sense.
Oh, yeah.
What is Cleave?
Cleave is an ability in 3.0, 3.5 Pathfinder, whereas depending on how many foes there are, but they have the ability to strike down multiple foes in combat.
If you kill one, you can take a swing at the one next to it.
Yes.
And then if you kill that one, if you have the right version of Cleave, you can go and kill another one and so forth. So right. You can basically...
It sounds similar to what's called follow-through damage in Hackmaster. Like if you were attacking an orc and he only had 2 hit points left and you did like 10 hit points of damage, if there's an opponent nearby, the additional 8 could follow through to the next guy. It sounds very similar to that.
Yeah, somewhat like
sounds that. Sounds very cinematic.
Yeah. Wow. Anyway. Okay, so thank you, Mr. Kojo.
I'm going to use that in my next game.
Yeah, I'm going to start using that too. I got a question here on Facebook. And you can go to facebook.com/RFIpodcast to join our little fun there, with which we do have over 1,000 members now, Jason.
Nice.
Anyway, this comes in from James. He says, hey, guys, just wanted to toss you a note. Great podcast, as always. Interesting.
Thank you.
Just finished with a recent episode about evil campaigns and was thinking, why do players tend to not get as picky about enforcing a good alignment, while evil doesn't tend toward puppy kicking and child stomping, nor does good tend towards altruism? So basically he wants to know, why is people not picky about enforcing good alignments, but they are about evil alignments?
Who, I don't understand. He's saying that people don't try to force good characters to do altruistic things and to behave that way. Of course they do.
Yeah, if you're playing a paladin, you better.
But like say neutral good or chaotic good, more people are hung up on, well, what an evil person does is what he's trying to say.
Well, first of all, it's going back to the misunderstanding of what an alignment is. An alignment isn't a personality type.
Right.
It is a literal – you are aligned to the forces of good, evil, law, chaos, and you're part of this greater cosmic struggle. So right. The individual things you do, you know, no, you don't have to go around kicking a puppy every time and acting like a cartoon character, nor do you have to be giving all of your money to the poor every time you walk through a town. What you have to be doing is serving this force that is continually roiling against each other. So that's the way that I feel. If you're going to play alignments, that's the way to do it. I do see people doing what he's saying. I do see people sticking to that.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, there you go.
Good answer. Good answer.
Yeah.
Survey said.
Bing, 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 bing.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard.
Hey. Anyway, in the face-to-face group I had, one of the players had asked me, how do you prevent a player from constantly killing off their character, not developing a backstory, and re-rolling up a new character all the time? Because he had a problem with a player that kept doing that over and over. He would go up a couple levels and be like, meh, kill the character off and start another character. I mean, okay. I gave him my advice in person. He wanted to know what the rest of you guys thought.
So, he would... this person.
So everybody else is leveling up to 5, and he's only on 1 all the time.
So this person like gets to a certain level with the character. He's like, I'm bored with this, and just kills him off. Basically,
yeah, purposely kills off the character and restarts another one. But the DM was not starting him at 1; he was just starting him with the group.
Well, there's the problem.
There,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I know that was. I advised him to put him at the lowest level, but he wanted.
Yeah, you start at first level. You keep on doing that stuff. I mean, if it wasn't purposely you're killing off a character, sure, you might come back into the group maybe with a character that's, I don't know, 2 levels lower. You know, but you know, constantly doing that. You know, once is what do they say? Once is a coincidence. Twice is a. Or 3 times is a pattern. Well, if it's more than 3 times, yeah, it's a pattern.
Right.
Oh, I thought you were going to be using the Oscar Wilde quote, to lose one's parent is a tragedy. To lose them both is just carelessness.
Well, this person's being careless with his characters. He constantly...
Exactly.
Right. So, you know, yeah, if I was the DM and I saw this pattern arising where he gets to a certain area with a character, he's not satisfied... Or he's just bored and he keeps on killing off and making new ones, I would say, well, next time you do this, your character is starting their first level. And I think that would be also very disruptive to the group as a whole.
Right.
Because as an adventuring party, especially in first edition, you're relying on the several pieces that is the whole of the party to survive. If you lose 1 or 2 party members, especially 2 or more, I mean, it could be very detrimental to the group's survival.
Right.
So you keep may on even, doing that. Yeah. You know, it's just not fair to the rest of the party either.
You may also want to figure out, why is he getting bored?
Yeah.
What's causing...
Let's
is
talk
it,
with him.
Yeah. Yeah. What's causing him to want to kill off his characters? If he's bored, is it because the other players are dominating the scenery and he thinks maybe if I start a new character or kill myself, that's how I get the attention? And
now,
like,
the players were getting annoyed at that, and he was telling me that, and he also was trying... He said it got to the point that he wasn't allowing the character to get killed, so then the character was trying dramatic things like jumping off cliffs and things like that, to the point that the players were actually screaming at this guy, so...
Well, I'm going to tell you right now...
Well, he's just being a jerk.
And at that point, yeah, he wouldn't be gaming with me.
This is my whole point on this thing here. One, I'm not a nice guy. I knew someone personally like that about 30 years ago that pulled that kind of stuff. That's it. You're gone, dude. Leave now. You're not coming back. You're not playing again. His actions are totally disruptive. They're not conducive to a good environment of gaming. He's got to go. You know what? Don't give him no. There's other gamers out there. Now, I wasn't sure. What game was he playing?
First edition.
Oh, he's playing for... Well, you know what? They're hard to find, but you know what? Get rid of him. He sounds like he's dead weight. Right. Find another player.
Right. I'm not that desperate to game that I'm going to have a bad gaming experience just so I can say I can game. Right. I'm very picky about when it comes to role playing. I do not role play at conventions with people I don't know. I'm never going to sign up for random event, RPG event at Gen Con. Cause,
you better sign up for mine.
Right. Well, I know you. That's different. But I'm not. If I don't know the people involved, I won't game with them, at least in an RPG format, because you never know what you're going to get. And it's so hit or miss.
But it's often hit. I mean, that's the thing. I've met good friends that way. In fact, the whole Dead Game Society, I met because I signed up to play a game with one of those guys completely at random. Didn't know him from Adam. Had a great time. Made a great friend.
I did RPGA once, and that was just a dreadful experience. Just it was like we had some players that
The RPGA.
Right. I think that soured me on the RPGA. So I'm like, okay, I know this isn't for me. And then I did have one amazing RPG just pickup game that at a convention, Gen Con, many years ago. But that was when a female friend of mine like actually found a group of people, and so she kind of vetted them. But I don't know. It's just, I'm just so leery about having that bad experience in my time at like a Gen Con or something like that. I have too much other things I could be doing than wasting my time on a
bad game.
But
those are so few and far between. Yeah. I mean, I've experienced it to where I made some awesome friends at the conventions through RPG events where I didn't know them at all.
Mm-hmm.
And met them there and every year I go back and, you know, I see them again. They become good friends at the convention.
Yeah.
Other times I've been involved in events where a person was such a terrible player and to a degree a terrible person, they were banned from the event. So you're going to get those extremes.
Right.
But with this guy, we don't know anything about his player. We don't know if he's a trouble player or if he's – I mean, yeah, if there's a lot of reasons to ask somebody to leave a game, and I can think of, you know, gamers that I wouldn't want to play with again. But there's also the possibility that this guy is a good guy, a good gamer, who is getting bored somehow, like Matt was saying, with the game. And as a DM, I think it's your job to ensure that everybody's having a good time. And if somebody's ruining it for everybody else, yes. But maybe there's something in your DM style that's causing this person to get bored, and it's worth asking them and doing it in a way that lets them feel okay telling you, hey, I don't really like the way the game is going, and that's why I keep doing this. And then see if, you know, if you can fix it, fix it. If you can't, sure. There's always times to let the gamers go their own ways. But try to, you know, see what the problem is.
There you go. Okay, cool. Hope that answered his question. And anybody can write in at rfistaff@gmail.com for sage advice or call 570-865-4210, the hotline.
Hotline.
Where zombies are standing by. Or you can call Nick personally at 5... Oh, sorry.
Whoa, hey.
588-2300. Nick.
Yeah, that's it.
1-800-CALL-NICK.
Calm I still kick now. That player to the side.
Yeah, we know, Will. Okay,
right over the cliff.
Less than one hit dice creatures are standing by for your call.
Yeah. And let's head to table manners.
Typical. Of all the evil creatures in the world, we like to find one with table manners.
And what, are you kidding me? I spent years cultivating the worst table manners on the planet.
Table manners.
Table manners. Well, this week we're actually, the 100th episode is actually going to be our Halloween episode. So we've all taken aside and looked over some books, and we're going to talk about some undead or walking dead campaigns. A lot of people have asked about this. So setting the scene for an undead or walking campaign. Have any of you done this before or used the Ravenloft module Walking Dead?
I've not used the Walking Dead, but I am using Night of the Living Dead, the module from second edition for my first edition campaign. That's actually the there's the domain that's run by the zombie lord that's all swampy. That's actually where my players currently are.
Oh, cool.
So they had just landed. They were on a ship. It got sucked into the mist. And now they find themselves around this swampy island they don't recognize. So right now I just have them trudging through this swamp and just the wildlife's attacking them. And they're so leery, they actually came across a band of friendly Vistani, and they were leery and distrusting. I mean, they were like, wait a minute, these guys are too helpful. Something's wrong. So yeah. I'm like, okay, I've already got them paranoid enough. Now's the time to start bringing out the undead.
It's best, I think, in undead-type campaigns or like Walking Dead or whatever, zombies, yeah, is to have them in confined areas, dark areas. So when they're running around, they're not sure what's going to pop up. I think that's better than an open area, in my opinion.
Right, right. That's why that swamp domain that escapes me off the top of my head is perfect, because it's dark. There's lots of trees, lots of noises that it could be just the wildlife. It could be undead. You're not sure exactly what's around the corner. And it just puts everyone on edge. And even if it's nothing, there's still, was that something and it just didn't attack me?
It's an undead cleric with a sharp weapon. Sorry.
Hey.
It's an orc with a pig head.
So what would
the pig with an orc head?
That's pretty scary. And what do you normally do, Nick, for these type of campaigns?
I guess I do my current Hackmaster campaign now is, I guess, similar to something like that, or my Dark World campaign, where it's not just. There's part of it where there is like a whole. There is if I'm trying to remember correctly, a kingdom or an empire where it is ruled by zombie masters, oh, and it's in the southern half of the continent, where it is ruled by basically the undead, and their armies are full of like zombies and skeletons and ghouls and what have you. And in this campaign world, just to give everybody a background, basically the forces of evil have won. And there's just this small bastion of good that's left in the game world. And yeah, you do have hordes of undead in there. So I think it's an incredible challenge when you put it like that, where the player characters are really the small glimmer of hope for the rest of the world in a world that has been taken over by the forces of darkness.
What about you, Will?
Well, I don't know where to start at.
Setting up the campaign.
Oh, my Lord. I'm trying to think the last time I did it. Yes, definitely done it. But I'm just trying to think in conjunction with, you know, The Walking Dead and everything. And I'm looking at this from, you know, various perspectives, you know, whether it's, you know, Call of Cthulhu, Chill, or we're talking about D&D.
D&D.
Yeah. When I did set it up for D&D, I used some material from both Chill and Call of Cthulhu on the zombies or whatever the Walking Dead were. And I'm just going to talk about zombies. I'm not going to talk about the other ones. And I used the real, I'm going to say real world tradition. I'm talking about like the old folklore of how to really kill zombies. And that was what the whole thing was back in the day. We talked about this on the forum, how people would memorize the monster manual, say, you know, I know what a zombie is. I know how to kill a zombie. I know their special abilities. Well, I put a twist on it by, you know, using the old folklore on zombies, you know, on destroying them, especially. My zombies, when it came down to it, I prefer oceans. I prefer water environments when it came down, the drowned ones or the that kind of stuff like there, because I want the players to deal with pirate zombies and everything like that, because they're in a whole new element. Not only are these zombies quicker, you know, you're dealing with a water element, which made it much more difficult to combat.
So, Will, what you just said was kind of interesting to me, that obviously you get players who know the monster manual and those kind of things, and I think there's a little bit of a acceptability to that. If they have a high level character, they've learned things in the wild, but like you say, you got to change it up a little bit so they don't know everything about your monsters. But if you introduce a walking dead, you know, an undead creature that doesn't conform to the kind of things that they're used to, how do you go about slowly, you know, getting them to understand what they can and cannot do? Like how are they supposed to overcome?
Okay, that is some of the best part of it, because when I play D&D, it's not simply a hack and slash campaign. There's going to be role playing. And, you know, it's funny how you mentioned that stuff where people get into that theatrical role stuff. I'm not talking about that kind of role playing where they always speak like a dwarf or an elf or a pixie or whatever. I just can't deal with that stuff. I'm going to give them a one-way ticket out of my house. But no, what happens is with anything that I deal with, undead or any type of creature that they run into where it's been modified to from other source settings, like I just said. Let me give you a prime example. With certain types of zombies in the particular campaign, now they're going to run into various types. Some zombies, in order to kill them, you have to put salt into their mouth and then sew their mouth shut.
Okay.
So yeah, that's going with traditional folklore.
Yeah. They're going to have to learn that as they talk to people around the countryside or wherever they're at and everything.
Great.
And that's how they have to learn, because I just don't give them that kind of information. The other one is certain types of zombies, you have to force them to face the ocean. And that is simple enough to, you know, destroy them. And various other means and methods of ancient folklore, old folklore on how to kill zombies or destroying them, or, you know, maybe you know, putting them in an unconscious state where you can destroy them with fire and so on and so on. I mean, everyone uses, let's just burn them to death. Let's just use acid, or let's just do this, or let's just cut them up into 10 million pieces and see what happens, or eat them, or, you know, whatever they want to do. But I like the players to explore and see what's out there and say, well, this is weird. We never ran into a zombie like this because we can't kill it. It's almost immune to our weapons. There's got to be a reason why. So that forces them, well, it doesn't really force them, but it enables them to move on and say, like, we need to find someone help and destroy these zombies we never encountered these before.
That's great. The idea of getting that role-playing in beforehand, mm-hmm. That's exactly what I was wondering.
Yeah. I was just going to say, like, what you were talking about, Will, about, you know, when you're talking about things like the undead, you know, like the Walking Dead, like zombies or ghouls or skeletons. One of the things I think would be really great to, like, pour it over in the first edition, there's two other different variant zombies that are in Hackmaster that I think would be really good and would just throw the players for a loop. And it's kind of a take on the traditional, you know, George Romero zombie. And there's two different versions. There's the brain-eating one, and there's the flesh-eating one. And the brain-eating one, they go for the brains of the victim. And the only way that you could take the brain-eating ones down is they have to have hits to the head. So called shots to the head are the only way they can hurt them. Plus, with the brain-eating ones and the flesh-eating ones, they are not made by magic. They were made by some other force, like some meteor hitting the earth and some radiation affecting the dead bodies. And so they cannot be turned. So I can go into a little more detail on the maybe on the forums on these two different types. There's the brain-eating one and the flesh-eating one. And if you get bit by these, yeah, there's a chance if you don't save versus poison, you will turn into either a brain-eating or a flesh-eating zombie. So, yeah, there's a couple little variants that I like to throw in there. The thing that they can't be turned, I love that. So,
what I really dug was in that Van Richten's Guide to the Walking Dead from Ravenloft was just kind of reminded me to make sure that there's a purpose. I mean, not a purpose, but what's the word I'm looking for? That the undead have something that they are after.
Yeah.
And you know, if you give them a need or a motivation so that they're always trying to get to that, it's better than having them just shambling around for no reason. And it just reminds me that the idea with any monster you put into your adventure or anything that happens to the adventure is you need to know the details behind why things are happening the way they are so that if they can't be turned, for example, you know the reason why. You can get that into the backstory. So like Will was saying about having the role-playing going on so they learn the things, you're ready with those reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. I don't know. My zombies, I never thought about the zombies having like a major purpose. I just, you know, thought throwing them in there just for the hell of it.
Sure. It's like the whole, you know, who created this zombie? Was it a magic user? Was it a evil cleric? Was it some radiation from outer space? And, you know, how did they get there? So that way, if anything comes up that you didn't explicitly prepare for, you'll be prepared for it because you know you could make up something on the spot knowing why they got there. You can make up stuff on the spot more easily.
Yeah, excellent. I mean, that, you know, you're talking about that kind of stuff. And that's the best part, you know, is to throw in those odd nuances. And I'm telling you, you know, and the players are going to have a fundamental and greater respect dealing with, you know, undead. And I love undead. That's probably my favorite monsters of all are undead. And zombies just it. That's just great.
Mm-hmm. I'm sitting here thinking about that. Like Jason said, have the idea of the background for them. I just never actually really thought about a whole background for them. It makes a lot of sense. He's right.
Right.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Like, I don't think you have to put too much into it.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think you have to put too much into it, is my point. You don't have to write a novel about it. No. You just have to know how'd they get there, why are they there, and what are they trying to do?
Right. Yeah, because they're not a naturally occurring thing. They're there. Something specifically created them. It's not like it's wildlife. Unless you have some sort of weird land where just the land itself creates the dead and causes them to come alive, but they give them a purpose, because otherwise it'll just be, okay, this is the filler monster until we get to something that actually matters. Like when, oh, look, it's some goblins. Okay, this is just something for us to do while we just slowing us down from doing something more important. if you give them a purpose, they are the something more important.
Yeah, sure. You just a virus outbreak, or like you said, from outer space, or whatever, something like that. I kind of go with the virus outbreak type thing. Or
yeah, that would work too. That's why I like the ones that are part of your standard zombies. These flesh eating ones, or the brain eating ones, because they can't be turned, and because they're not made by magic, and you know, you get bit by them, you know, there's a chance that, you know, you'll become one of them. So it'll throw the players for a loop. I mean, that in itself could be a build on an adventure on, like, for these zombies, for example, this different type. It's something that they never ran into before, and it becomes a real big mystery. So, you know, they're going to grab Shaggy and Scooby, and they're going to head off in the mystery machine. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe not.
Wait. But,
hey kids, we got a mystery to solve. So maybe the thing is, they're gonna, you know, find out where this meteor or crashed, or where this strange virus came from. So, you know, it definitely puts the player characters in for a loop.
So that's a Walking Dead campaign setup, pretty much. I don't know how much more to add to it. Does anyone else have any more to add to this?
Well, I mean, besides, for those that people that don't know what we're using, I know we all talked about it with the Van Richten's Guide to the Walking Dead and everything. Make sure they know that this is from the Swords and Sorcery line for D20.
Well, yeah, we were just using it as a...
Yeah, no, and I'm going to tell you something. No, that's a great example. It's a good thing you do this, because this also, and this embraces the thought. A lot of people don't like D20 games, but there is a lot, I mean, just a phenomenal amount of great material out there where you could take this material and convert it right over to your first and second edition games, if that's what you like.
Absolutely. Right. That's why I like the idea of like a campaign world where basically evil's won. So, I mean, you're talking about very limited resources for the player characters. They don't know who to trust. So I think making it like a world where evil pretty much has taken over, and they're that last bastion of hope.
Right.
You know, that and throwing in a whole thing with undead, like with, you know, hordes of zombies and ghouls that are part of the regular armies of the world. You know, that just puts a whole new dimension on things.
Right.
And I think the players are going to get far more into survival mode than actually, oh, we're going to go to the next great dungeon and we're going to get all this treasure. Now it becomes like, okay, when we go to the next town, who's going to go in first and make sure that it's like okay for us to go there?
Yeah, and remember, not all zombies have to be human. You can have your humanoid zombies.
Yeah. Giant zombies.
Giant zombies, bugbears, because in the Monster Manual 2, they have the zombie monster and the juju zombie. And those are zombies that drain levels.
And I believe juju zombies cannot be turned either, because they're the ones that are made by that plant.
Right, and they are also...
Yeah, the yellow musk creeper.
The yellow musk... Oh, yeah, I'm thinking of the yellow musk creeper zombie.
Right, yeah, the juju zombies, they actually are able to climb as a six-level thief, so some juju zombies are chasing a player. Oh, we'll just go up on top, up this ladder, or climb up a tree, we'll be okay. Then all of a sudden, they're just scaling it.
Scattering around like cockroaches.
Right. Yeah, because they're actually part of the negative material plane, so they can also only be hit by +1 or better magic weapons.
Right.
So,
just for edification, the juju zombies are created by magic users who drain all life levels from humans or man-sized humanoids by means of an energy drain spell.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. On that note, game mechanics coming up next.
You think I'm mad? Perhaps I am.
What are you, a wizard, a genius?
Darn, a perfectly good brain wasted.
Game mechanics.
Okay, here we are at Game Mechanics, and we'll be talking about in our round table about The Walking Dead and having an undead dominated campaign, basically. And how we can add another dimension to a campaign by adding some sort of fear or fright mechanic into the campaign. I could kind of kick this one off. I think it's kind of easy. You could easily port over something like Sanity from Call of Cthulhu into D&D. And to give a little background, Call of Cthulhu, which is kind of like a basis for it was based off the basic role-playing system, which was kind of like a, if I can use the term, bastardization of original D&D, is where you have one of the stats now in Call of Cthulhu is Sanity. And I don't have my books in front of me right now, but if I remember correctly, Sanity is based off of, I believe, your Wisdom times 5. And that is your Sanity. Or it's your intelligence plus your wisdom, and you take that total divided by 2 and then multiply it by 5, something like that. But there is a mechanic in there that is your sanity score. And whatever that is, whenever you see a particular creature from the Cthulhu mythos, or if you read one of the nasty books, you might lose sanity if you fail your roll. And you lose a certain amount. So that's one thing that could be, I guess, ported into AD&D is a sanity roll. If you go under, you know, a certain amount, if you lose so much in a certain time, you might get temporary insanities. You lose so much, you can go permanently insane. You get certain phobias. So that's something you could bring into the game if you want to have something that's kind of a mechanic for fear or fright or something like that. And you can also improve sanity too.
I mean, you're talking about something in a sort of a permanent sense here. I mean, I know you say you have temporary sanity and all that kind of thing, but in a individual combat sense, or just your fear that's coming up there, you know, fear obviously is something that exists in first edition rules, whether you're looking at you know, literal things like the fear spell, or you know, look at morale, really, is what you're kind of thinking about here.
Yeah,
so
it is.
The question
kind of
is, well, no, it literally is. I mean, in the sense that if you're looking at the morale of a monster you're fighting or of a henchman that's with you, you have rules that tell you how likely they are to turn tail and run. So you could expand that those mechanics and try to bring in something specific if you wanted to have it more than just a simple run away or don't run away kind of situation. Maybe something where you have, during the combat, if you want fear to affect your performance, you know, make you have a minus to hit or something like that, or cause you to maybe even exhibit some berserker characteristics, but maybe without the strength.
Wasn't there an article in Dragon about new adventurers meeting horrific events on the first time, having to roll something?
Right. That's also in. You can actually just steal the terror rules from second edition, Ravenloft.
Yeah. Okay. You can do that too. Okay. Yeah.
Tell me about them. I don't know them. I'm actually looking in Unearthed Arcana right now to try and see if there's. I thought there was something in here about this specifically.
Right. Well, Will can probably tell us. He's more familiar with second edition than the rest of us. There's.
Yeah.
What's that? What did you want to know?
The terror rules in Ravenloft.
Okay, yes. You have your power checks and your horror checks.
That's it. Okay.
Yeah, the power checks and horror checks. The power checks, though, is when you are influenced by... Basically, what happens is the Ravenloft power is always trying to corrupt the player. So they will do certain things in there to see how you would react. If you react to it badly, you have to make a power check.
Right.
If you fail, then you move more and more closer to the dark side. Real similar to the effect used in Dragonlance. Remember that chart we talked about?
Okay. Yeah.
It's real similar to that. Now, horror checks, you know, well, that's a whole different thing and everything onto itself. And when you run into your horrible things, you have to make that saving throw. And if you fail, it has, you know, profound impacts upon you and so on.
So that's like that would be like a sanity roll.
Yes. Now, you see, now I like the sanity. And I was listening to all y'all, and y'all have very good points and everything. And I'm trying to figure out what could you do in D&D? This is the problem with D&D. This is assuming that the player characters start off at first level, have never seen or witnessed any horrible things in life or seen horrible monsters and everything. It's hard for me to fathom, you know, in a D&D setting or any setting where your first level character and you haven't heard about a zombie or a ghost or anything like that. However, this is where I get where I look at Poltergeist, the movie Poltergeist. You all remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Remember when she saw that horrible creature and her hair turned white?
Yes.
No.
That's how I like to make the effects so profound, is where they see something for the first time that's just horrible. You heard about it but never seen it. Then look what happens. Your hair turns gray or something like that, or you know, whatever it was in there. I mean, I'm sorry. You know what actually I was thinking about was the movie It. Remember when the kids saw and all his hair turned completely white? Yeah, Stephen King's It, where he saw the spider.
Is that with the clown?
Yeah, the clown.
Yeah, Pennywise.
Yeah, the kids saw the spider creature in its original form, and that's made his hair all turn white. I mean, that's how scared he was to death. So I like the horror impact more so than the sanity, because you're adding a new element in there, which, I mean, it all just varies on how someone wants to do it. How can you do it appropriately? I mean, is a goblin very scary looking? I mean, this doesn't apply just to to undead, but I mean, to any horrible creature. I think I would be more terrified of maybe a red dragon than I would a goblin or maybe a gnoll.
Well, that's why you have fear checks when you go up against dragons.
Yes, well, there's already a rule already in place for fear, though.
Right.
There already is a ruling. I'm just talking about just your general. What about giants? I mean, that's a 6-foot human, and you're seeing a 18-foot tall giant. How would that impact the character? Would you use a horror check or would you use a sanity check? I mean, they both could be the same thing pretty much and everything.
They are almost in a way. But
yeah.
I guess one would be – I see what you're saying, because you are dealing with an actual fantasy game. The effects of sanity wouldn't be so drastic, if at all, because you're living in a fantastical world. Your characters are.
Right.
Versus another game like Call of Cthulhu, which is kind of a simulation of real world, and you're experiencing weird, extraordinary things. Then that's a different thing.
So
well, the question...
No, go ahead, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the question to me comes is, you know, in your game, why are you bringing in, for example, horror checks or sanity checks? I would say that if you are running part of your campaign or, you know, a specific adventure within your campaign, that you want to bring in something extra. You know, you want to really make this adventure all about the undead, and you want to make it a little bit more fun this time around. So you could introduce this mechanic that gives you some of that opportunity. I don't know if somebody wanted to make this part of their whole campaign all the time. That's another question. But I would just see this as saying, you've got adventurers that are clearly, you know, they've been out there fighting scary creatures. So depending on their backstory, most things are not going to, you know, give them horror in that sense.
Exactly.
But here I'm bringing them into castle disturbingness, and I'm going to have these I'm going to have these undead that I've created just for this adventure. That they've never seen anything like that, and I want to put a new mechanic in. So let's say I want to get the players to have to get through it in a certain amount of time. So I'm going to start introducing sanity that they lose as they encounter things. I can see it as being really fun for that one adventure.
Right. Okay.
Now, see, and that's a good point. And there's some other effects into the game where people don't take into consideration. Character death. How does that impact the rest of the players?
That's a good point. Yeah.
Or what about if someone takes... Now, I'm just saying, let's say we go to a high-level adventure. Someone takes, like, 30, 40 points of damage. It's got to be a grievous wound. It just, you don't witness it all the time, so that should have some type of profound, not a profound impact, but some type of impact on all those that witness that thing. Or if you see a character being turned to stone by a Medusa, or if you see someone, you know, being that died from being poisoned by a Black Widow spider, and that's a horrible death. All those things, it's just not encountering monster, but also the other residual effects from encountering creatures that kill a character. Or, you know, something to that effect. You see what I'm saying?
Dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
It's a good, you know, what you're saying about how does it affect you when you see the person next to you die. I've been playing Godlike lately. Any of you guys ever play that game?
No.
I've heard of it. I've heard of it.
No. Really fun. It's a superhero game set in World War II, but the superheroes are called talents. They're not superheroes, and they're very mundane. You know, they'll have a little bit of a power. And one of the reasons I think some people who play this game like it so much is because it's very deadly. You know, you've got these talents that maybe they can fly or shoot flames, but they're still going to get killed by a bullet. And they have a concept in here. They have will. And will is very important in the game Godlike. Your will,
you're very important in the game Godlike.
Your will score is sort of a mental constitution. And it's what enables you to do these great things. And if you lose that, you lose the ability to do these great things. But what it also does is it can cripple you in other ways if your will starts getting affected. So in the game Godlike, when you see the guy next to you get shot or killed in a horrible way, it affects your will score. When you see that you're becoming overwhelmed by the odds that you're facing, you start losing your will in the face of these overwhelming odds. It's a cool mechanic that I think could work towards fear as well. So maybe you – sanity or will, you could put those in similar terms. But either way, I like the idea of I just find that when I'm doing an adventure, especially in a campaign where I've had the same people playing for a long time, it's always fun to introduce a little one-off thing, you know, some sort of mechanic that, you know, just – people haven't done before. It almost becomes like a mini game in a sense. And bringing that in, whether you call it sanity or will, and I would definitely recommend looking at the Godlike book. It's published by Arc Dream Press, one of the most well-written games I think out today. Look at those kind of mechanics and see how you can adapt them.
Right. And it's funny how you bring up the will save or the will ability or whatever the case may be, because that's very analogous to D20 with the will save, which is based on the same premise, especially in Pathfinder, when fear is an introduction or is the catalyst to a situation, that character has to make a will save, which is based on his wisdom.
So basically what we have here is we can either A, draw from other game systems like Godlike or Call of Cthulhu and pour it in something like that will or sanity roll. Or we can have something like that's already in D&D, like in second edition. There's that, was it fear or a horror? Horror check?
Yeah, from Ravenloft.
So, yeah, from Ravenloft. You can use either one. So that's pretty cool. And it sounds like whatever you choose, it sounds like it'll work no matter what you use.
Yeah. Now, and you brought Ravenloft up, and I encourage people, look at the second edition Ravenloft setting, but also look at the D20 setting, because they really enhanced a lot of that stuff. If you're really into that horror element, I'm telling you. And yeah, check into it. I mean, really look into it. And, you know, another setting we didn't bring up that we failed to mention concerning, and you know, it's not more or less, is Mask of the Red Death.
It's gothic horror.
It's gothic horror in Ravenloft. Yeah, and basically it's more or less like a Call of Cthulhu in, you know, Ravenloft. I'm not Call of Cthulhu, but you know where you
it's Victorian era.
Victorian era horror, yeah.
Yeah, Victorian gothic horror in like 1880s.
Puffy shirts and
real world, quote unquote.
Yeah, take a look into that setting, because that's a very interesting setting.
Yeah. No thanks.
I think it sounds pretty cool. Yeah, no, I definitely for this type of horror that you're talking about too. It sounds cool.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll go on and we'll hear from our listeners about what they think about adding a fear or fright mechanic. You know, you can email us at rfistaff@gmail.com, or you can call our hotline. Is that right?
Yes, I'm just laughing.
I know you're laughing because I got it right. Or you can call the hotline, 570-865-4210.
Jason, you know? it's only taken Nick like 60-something episodes to get the address.
Yeah,
right.
It also helps to have the RFI website on my computer up, so I can look at it.
Great. Number? So maybe in another 100 episodes, he'll stop giving clerics swords.
Ooh. Hey. And on that high note, I guess we'll move on to Creature Feature.
Creature Feature.
And now we're here for the Creature Feature. We're going to start talking about types of undead. What do we have here? We have zombies, is that it?
Yes. Different types of zombies, different types of walkers. From looking at TV shows and movies, you know, obviously you can take inspiration from there. There's, like you were saying before, the virus zombies.
Yeah, the brain-eating ones or the flesh-eating zombies.
Right.
Hate zombies.
You're going to go traditional just shamblers, or they're going to be runners, or they're going to be people that can crawl different ways. That's basically what we're talking about here.
You know what I like? Because I really do hate zombies. I am so tired of zombies. If I never see another one as long as I live, I'm
agree.
Fine.
I absolutely hate them. Even though I'm using them in my home campaign, I hate zombies. I hate zombies.
It's not zombies' fault either. They're just so played out. Everything's got to be a dang zombie now. But going back to that Van Richten's Guide to the Walking Dead, I had never thought about this idea of – I don't know if I want to call this a zombie, but let's call them zombies because we're in the Creature Feature – of not even looking dead, or maybe just barely, you know, not being decayed, not anything else, right, almost to the point that they could pass as your neighbors.
Yeah, a living zombie, if you will.
That's scary.
Wasn't there a type of creature like that in Chill?
What's Chill?
That Chill role-playing
game? It's a Mayfair horror role-playing game.
Okay.
Because I remember there was a creature like that in Chill where it pretty much almost looks like regular human being.
Yeah,
check the pulse.
Well, actually, what it came down to is with some of the zombies in there, with the intelligent zombies, with Chill, they had special abilities. And they had the ability to mask their true presence from the living. So it made it appear that they were still living beings, but in actual reality, their guise was that of, you know, yeah, they was actually, you know, cannibals or what have you.
Right. Yeah.
That sounds properly frightening.
What about the idea of an intelligent zombie? Like in the movie, what was it, Land of the Dead, Day of the Dead? When the one zombie was actually giving orders to the other zombies.
Right. Yeah, there's actually something like that in First Edition. If you go to the Lords of Darkness REF5 for Forgotten Realms, they have living zombies in there where they're performing coordinated attacks because they're led by the one – controlled by the one, like, lead zombie who has intelligence, and he's, like, the general for the rest of the zombies. So they're all of a sudden pulling off far more coordinated and strategic attacks that make no sense at all. If you just think, oh, these are a bunch of zombies, until you discover, oh, wait, they're controlled by, like, a master zombie, if you will, that's giving them the directions. And they're basically his drones.
Oh, yes, definitely. That's the whole point of, you know, the imagination. Take the creature, do something to it, make it different so that players are just, you know, they get confused by dealing with them.
I have to beg to differ at the beginning of the segment when Jason said he's so sick of zombies, they're so played. I don't think they're played. I think they're in now because everybody's sick of vampires at this point.
Oh, God, I'm so sick of that. Sick of it.
Oh, man, you had to bring that up in sparkly things. Vampires, werewolves, and zombies, I can tell you where they can all go. They need to move on to something different.
Well, I mean,
you know what they're going to do? They're just going to ruin your next favorite thing if they move on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's kind of weird, though, because, and like I said, and you all bring up that Van Richten's Guide again. I mean, really check into that. That is really one of the best books out there. You know, different types of zombies. I'm going to tell you, another alternative, if you have the funds, get various monster books from various systems. Scarred Lands, Kingdom of Kalimar. I'm trying to think of some of the other settings right now that's out there and everything. Go to, I can't think of it right now, but they have all different types of zombies.
There's the one game, All Flesh Must Be Eaten.
Don't Rest Your Head is another one.
I don't know if you again?
Don't Rest Your Head is another one.
What is that?
Another zombie-type game.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Well, I saw some new ones now that just came out. Now, this is just this board games, but, you know, like City of Horror, I think there's a new one that's come out where it's pretty interesting.
The Walking Dead TV show has its own game, too.
Oh, it does now.
There's two board games. I saw two of them.
There was one they were promoting at Gen Con 2010, no, 11. No, 10.
What was the cover on it? Do you remember what the cover looked like on there?
It was a drawing of the comic book, actually.
Okay, so it's a drawing of the comic book. There's another one that's out that actually shows the cast from the current TV show.
Yeah, that's more of a board game. This was more of a role-playing game they were testing out.
Oh, really?
Hmm.
I haven't seen it like that, but there's so many games out there. Go to Chill, go to Call of Cthulhu. There's so many games. Beyond the Supernatural, I forgot about that, by Palladium.
Oh, yeah, Beyond the Supernatural by Palladium. About
that. Check that one out, because I'm telling you, there's so many times. I tell you, I like dealing with zombies like the drowned ones, the ones that deal with water because they're bloated, they stink, and they got all the little worms coming out of them. Or there's the one zombie they described in Van Richten's Guide, and I like this one, but he's a creature in the Sword and Sorcery thing, and the Scarred Lands, where it's got a big mouth, mm-hmm. and it can take huge chunks of flesh from your body because it's trying to devour you whole.
Yeah. I was reading that. I'm like, that's pretty nasty.
There's some nasty character
In Dragon 138, Moldvay wrote an article where he wrote up some zombie variants. One was Le Grand Zombie, spelled Zombi. And it's a magic user.
Oh, nice.
So it'll either be casting clerical spells or magic user spells, and it's leading the horde of zombies. So that's like the zombie general.
Yeah, your zombie master. Sweet.
Right. Other books you can...
But you know, the thing is, the last comic convention I went to was the Philadelphia one we had a little while back here. And as I was walking through the various art halls, all the different comics artists doing everything, I would say, no exaggeration, about 75% was zombie themed. Oh. It was, you know, you can get these posters where it's like your favorite movies turned into zombies. This
yeah.
turned into, it's gotten to the point that geek culture is being threatened by two things that will take it over, and that is anime and zombies. Eventually, it will be nothing but anime zombies.
Cool.
That's all that'll be left. And it's getting old, it's boring, it's played to death, and it needs to stop.
Well, you know, better than being vampires or Sparkle.
Honestly, at this point, I would take vampires instead of zombies if we could just move, just so we could have two things instead of one.
Well, now, since you brought up vampires, I will say one thing. I just watched a cool movie this week, and I don't know which one of y'all liked. I don't know if it was Matt or Nick. I saw that Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer.
Yeah.
I want to see.
And was it good?
Yeah.
That was actually an excellent movie.
Yeah. A friend
well, see, here's
really?
The thing is that,
well, a friend of mine was actually in
Vampires.
Yeah. A friend of mine was actually in Abraham Lincoln versus the Zombies.
Yeah.
The B movie knockoff.
Yeah. All by Asylum?
Yes. A friend of mine was one of Lincoln's bodyguards.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, he's the one that jumped
off.
Didn't do
a very good job, obviously.
No, yeah. he ended up killing himself to avoid being – shooting himself in the head when he, like, jumped off a wall and, like, broke his ankle. So his character shot himself in the head so the zombies wouldn't turn him into a zombie.
It's the honorable thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, my problem with some of these zombies.
If you're into the vampires, at least there's actually genuinely good stuff out there. There's a lot of junk. But, you know, just like Theodore Sturgeon said when somebody told him, why do you write science fiction? 80% of science fiction is crap. And he said, look, 80% of everything is crap.
Yeah.
But in the case of vampires, you know, Anne Rice's books, if you go back, they were good. Yeah. And Poppy Z. Bright, she's a good author. There's good stuff out there because you can actually explore maybe some deeper motivations and meanings behind them. And yeah, if we get some junk out there that we don't like, that's fine. But with zombies, how far can you really go? It's just an excuse to feel better about shooting a human in the face.
Well, see, this is what my deal is with zombies. I saw this one horrible zombie movie. I think you all know it. I don't know if you all seen it or not. But they shot fireworks. And when the zombies saw the fireworks, they were enamored by the fireworks. And they would just stand there and look at them. Do you know which movie that was?
Land of the Dead or Day of the Dead, one of the two.
I thought, like, seriously? Shoot fireworks?
John Leguizamo was in that movie. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, give me a
Well, if John Leguizamo, if a movie's got John Leguizamo, 10 points no matter how bad the movie is.
Yeah.
That guy is just the best.
Yes. Well, if you want to get good, I always thought that From Dusk Till Dawn was a fun film.
Yeah.
Where you talk about vampires because no one expected it.
Yeah, but that movie was good for the first half, and it's like someone took a dump on the rest of the script.
Okay.
And wipe their butt with the rest of the script. It was so good, the first half of that movie, and it was just like the rest of the.
But since you're talking about that, what about that movie that that Will Smith did? What was it called again?
Well, not the Omega Man. It's the new title for the. I Am Legend.
I thought that was excellent.
Yeah, that was a good movie. Yeah,
because it's actually based off the Richard Matheson story, I Am Legend, which is very good.
And Jason even said a good movie, The Omega Man. Same storyline. That The Last Man on Earth, I believe it was, too, was the other title.
Yeah, they're all based off the same story, yeah.
And that is just, that's the kind of stuff that I thrive for, but it's always the same. I want something different. I want something just changed. And
There's only two zombie movies that ever need to exist, and they already do. One of them is, I'm going to call Omega Man what's the Will Smith one again?
I Am Legend.
Basically the same movie. It's based on the same story. It's two great actors doing it in different ways. That's awesome. And then you've got Shaun of the Dead, which is also brilliant.
Oh, that's such a fun film.
And now you're done. And now you've done all the zombie movies you ever have to, except maybe the Woody Harrelson one.
What about Night of the Living Dead, a 1960s classic?
I never saw it.
Never seen it? Oh, you got to see it.
Not gonna.
Well, they did a remake of it anyway, so...
Not going to see that.
You know, I just thought of something else.
What?
You talked about these movies. And I said, y'all don't got to be started on these movies. What was that one movie? Was it 30 Days After?
Oh, 28 Days Later.
And what was that other one?
28 Weeks Later?
No. There was another movie where the plane crashed into the swampy water and it got into the water supply.
My Dinner with Andre?
No.
No.
You all seen it. It was
Sleepless in Seattle.
The Crazies.
Oh, the Crazies.
Oh, wow.
Remember that?
Yeah, I've heard of it, though.
Yeah, that's that movie, yeah.
Check those movies out because, again, you're dealing with... See, I like talking about zombies. I like different types of zombies and different effects. And this is why I say pick up this book if you really want different... These zombies are all created by other external factors and everything. I mean, are they typically zombies? I guess they're not, but, I mean, they still eat you. I guess.
Yeah. They have the obedient dead, the hungry dead, the restless dead, and they have different weaknesses. And how necromancy.
The foppish dead.
Yeah.
The foppish dead.
Yes.
I would so prefer the foppish dead.
What about?
How do my brains look in this?
A zombie colossus. In that Dragon article, there actually is a 30-foot tall zombie that's created. It's a hungry dead, and it's just like a massive colossus. And just imagine, like, going through, like, the city of Waterdeep. You have your 30-foot-tall zombie just wrecking havoc, and the players have to do battle with it. It's your Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, except it's a giant zombie.
That's almost as fun as a big robot dinosaur.
Right.
Right. But don't forget the 50-foot colossus in Castle Amber X2.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
That was controlled by a guy. And remember, the only way to defeat it was having that powder, and you had to go up there in a flying carpet to fly up and fling it in his face.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the only way you could defeat it. You couldn't turn it.
There's some other books you can look at. Eden Studios has a bunch of them. Like you said, All Flesh Must Be Eaten, I think, is done by them. And
One of the supplements is called Dungeons and Zombies.
Yes.
And it's very, very good. If you want to run like a fantasy campaign, but it's overrun by undead, that's a great source book.
There's also the Army of Darkness RPG, which you can do one of the Bruce Campbell games and fight against a skeleton army if you want. And zombies, for that matter, too. And you can also use the Buffy the Vampire Slayer books, too, but as well.
I heard that was a good game, too.
Yeah, they're all good games.
It's funny you mention Army of Darkness. I just heard that Raimi's redoing Evil Dead.
The trailer is out already. It should be coming out sometime next year.
With Bruce Campbell, right?
No, Bruce
Campbell. No.
Whatever, not
He's not even
going to
make a cameo?
As far as I know, he said no, but he never knows.
Just his chin, though.
He could be in there as a cameo. He said no before and shown in, so who knows? He's too busy doing Burn Notice right now, so.
Yeah. I liked his movie, Bubba Hotep. That was a fun film.
My favorite one of him so far is My Name is Bruce.
Oh, yeah. I see that one. That's good.
So anyway, there's some types of zombies, some things to think about and chew on. Ha ha.
Hey, look, wow, brother. I couldn't digest that joke.
I know.
I just wanted to say one thing. We was talking about how to modify some of these zombies.
No, you can't say anything. We're done.
Just a little bit.
No, we're out of time. No, go ahead. Well, I'm kidding.
Oh, okay. I noticed in this book that some of these zombies were given dark auras, which was actually pretty good. Some of them give off a fear aura, an aura of frost, an unholy aura, a dead zone, and a ghostly fire. I'm serious. If you want to vamp up your zombies.
Make them sparkle?
Hey, let me wrap it up here. Stupid dead jokes. But you got to pick up this book, that Richten's Guide to the Walking Dead. Got to pick it up.
You have to pick up all the books that were done by Sword and Sorcery Studios. It's like taking Ravenloft and giving it to White Wolf was like gold in their hands.
It was
the best thing they could have done with that. But anyway, pick them up. They're not that expensive. You can get them for like $5 a piece, half-price books. Probably $10 on Amazon. They're really good inspiration material for horror campaigns. There's a whole bunch of them. I think there's got vampires and other types of undead.
That Dungeons and Zombies book by Eden Studio, so you can get that on PDF, too, from their website.
Okay.
Yes. Where's Jason at?
What?
Where's Jason at?
I'm right here.
Oh, okay. You played first edition AD&D. Yeah. I just had a question for you.
Okay.
No, just one simple question. When you had humans run into ghosts and they failed their saving throw and they aged 10 to 40 years, how did you handle that?
Well, there's rules for aging. If they're going to actually hit those levels, then that's going to happen to them. So if they're going to lose some constitution as a result or anything like that or gain some wisdom, that's going to happen. It's going to be an actual aging, not just an appearance.
Yeah, for example, like if you have a 20-year-old character runs into a ghost and he ages 40 years, he's now 60 years of age, how do you handle the character from there on as far as whether he's going to be playable?
Well, I mean, if he's a magic user, then he will still be playable. If he's a fighter, then that's pretty much end of the line for him.
Well, because if you use those aging rules in the DMG, absolutely.
I just thought of something. What if a child ran into a ghost and he ages 20, 30 years? It's now big in D&D.
Huh.
It's the Tom Hanks movie.
Well, they got it.
They wouldn't grow in size and like that type of age, and they would age physically, but not like growth-wise.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting because I just said that I would do the wisdom, and you just made a good point, Matt, which is where would you get that wisdom from?
Right.
So, I've always just played it as this aging actually happened, and I'm going to give them the wisdom. I've given them the wisdom to go with it as – you've got a magic user at least that, you're not out of the game at this point. But if you have a child get hit by a ghost, I think it would be a lot more interesting to just play them as mentally the same as before, but just physically older.
Excellent. I love that.
Okay, so he's a little old man with a beard.
And there's nothing wrong with, maybe you let the fighter state. Any of you guys I know that maybe some of the others aren't, but I don't know about you, Will. Fans of Terry Pratchett?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
So, he's got Cohen the Barbarian.
Yeah, Cohen the Barbarian, you betcha.
So old that he just can't die anymore.
What's
his name? Cohen. Cohen.
Oh, the Barbarian. Cohen the Barbarian. That, my last name is Cohen. I wonder if he's talking about me.
Probably is, yes. Your last
don't
name
is flatter yourself too much.
Cohen, like,
yeah,
the,
that's a, yeah.
Like the priest. Yeah.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah. And so you're a priest. You are of the priestly class.
That is correct. I am of the Kohenim, the Levites. Yes.
Exactly. So so he's you. Cohen the Librarian. Or sorry, not the Librarian, Cohen the Barbarian.
Oh, great.
he's so old that he's just gotten too tough to kill anymore.
Okay.
So why not have some fun with that? Let your character have a 80-year-old fighter.
I'll whip your butt, Shunny.
Yeah. Well, I just saw this guy. I'm sure you've seen the video's been going kind of viral for the past couple of days of this 93-year-old weightlifter.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So, that guy's pretty tough. I'm not going to take him on, so there you go.
Yeah.
He did it for the hot 70-year-olds. Right.
I know. I love that.
Yeah.
He's going for the cute 70-year-old girls at the beach.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like Helio Gracie was doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu up until his late 80s, until he died.
Jack LaLanne, look at him. I mean, he was a pretty strong guy up until the end of his days.
Right. So what they're lacking in physical ability, they're making up for with their experience and technique.
Nice.
Just look at Ric Flair. He's 107 and he still wrestles.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's head into Dragon's Horde next.
The Dragon's Horde.
And now we go to the Dragon's Horde, and we're going to actually talk about designing weapons to actually do battle with these hordes of zombies. I mean, we've talked about also having like the variant zombies where you can only have certain things damage them, be it salt in the mouth or headshots. When first thinking about this, I actually went back to the Holy Sword of Griswold. I mean, really, think about it. It was from that Undead book where there's legions of skeletons. Those could easily be legions of zombies.
True.
So why couldn't you have your Holy Sword of Griswold that sprays holy water at them?
Ketchup.
Yes, ketchup. Yes, maybe they get distracted by the ketchup and they all just pounce on the pile of ketchup. But so I also thought, what would I want if I had a horde of zombies? A holy hand grenade of Antioch.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Right, yeah. I could see using that in a game where you have the holy hand grenade, but you have to perform this ceremony to be able to use it and throw it, so you have this impending horde of zombies advancing. So the other players have to somehow keep this horde back while you're able to pull off the giant ceremony to lob the hand grenade, and hopefully you remember 2 comes before 3.
And 5 does not come after 2, so.
Exactly. So, what other thoughts did you guys have for, like, weapons to, like, deal battle with zombies? Other than just the standard, okay, I have a giant magic weapon that I can just hack into them easily or kill them with one hit.
Well, that's mine was basically a vengeance weapon. I designed, a while back I did this, designed a holy axe of vengeance. Basically, it's a +1 axe, does D6 damage. On a 19, it does. You do double holy damage against the creature. And on a natural 20, the axe will instantly cut off the head of the zombie.
Okay. So, yes, it's like your auto headshot.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Well, I got one, actually. I'm sorry. It's from Hackmaster. But it's a cool weapon.
Okay.
It's called the Morningstar Glory, +4. And this one, the Morningstar Glory, deals bone-crushing blows to the undead. The ebon steel ball is topped with gold and silver spikes, capped with thrice-blessed mithril. Undead, which are primarily skeletal in nature, take 4d4 +4 points of damage per hit. Other undead take 3d4 +4. Damage against non-undead is 2d4 +4. So that's the Morning Star of Glory.
What about you, Jason?
I don't.
You don't what? Have a weapon at all?
No, I don't.
You wouldn't make one up for your game?
I didn't. Okay. I was unprepared. I didn't study for the test. I'm sorry. I didn't know there was a quiz.
But if you could design a weapon, what parameters would you put on it on the fly?
Am I the only one left? Can anybody go else? Anybody else go? Come on.
Will?
No, to be honest with you, I never, ever in my entire gaming career of 37, 38 plus years ever create a weapon specifically for that. I used what was available, and I just did with that. Now, when we're talking about Ravenloft and everything, there were other weapons that I used specifically from those systems, so...
Yeah. I could even see maybe some sort of gnomish incendiary contraption, like the giant gnomish flamethrower, and you just light them all on fire and watch their flesh burn. I mean, most of what I keep thinking is you have this mass of zombies, and it's more like a quest item, not something you're going to just be using in your everyday. It's like, okay, we have this giant threat, we have to make this one contraption work. And to make all the zombies go away. That's kind of where my mind keeps going, with just different ways of doing that.
How about instead of offensive, a defensive, like an amulet you could put on, and the zombies think you're one of them?
Yes! And I'm glad you brought that up, because, again, You know, I like the thing on what they talk about the salient weaknesses of zombies in that Van Vechten's Guide to the Walking Dead. And again, this provides more, you know, material because of these allergens of how to defend yourself against certain zombies. Like the one I really liked in here was the fascination one. Or the aversion one, where you have a mirror and you show the mirror to the zombie, and the zombie will recoil from his own presence because he, you know, gets a grasp of what he became or whatever.
Oh yeah, seeing this as a reflection for the first time, yeah.
Yeah, or you know, there's a fascination allergen. There is a protection, an enragement, and a remembrance. Or if you know, like for, and this is where it comes in again. Let's say you encounter a zombie of a female, and you spray that particular person's special perfume in there, and it looks around and smells it, and then stops, and you know, it's defenseless maybe for a round or two, right, or maybe whatever. So again, those allergens. Prime examples of how to really spice up zombies, but you got to learn about the zombies first before you can defeat them.
Right. Well,
yeah, not every person has the same aversion. Right. So.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And this is what I'm saying. These allergens, great section in this book. I thought that was just brilliant.
Right. Or what about making one where the zombies want flesh, but any flesh, including zombie flesh? So they start either consuming themselves or consuming the other zombies.
Ugh. That's nasty.
Yeah, so you turn them upon themselves. So it's like, why does it have to be living flesh? Why can't it be dead flesh?
Because they only want it fresh. They don't want it, you know, outdated.
Right. Actually, you know, that's a good idea right there. And I believe that's been revisited on that one portion of Ravenloft where the characters actually die when...
Necropolis.
Necropolis. And the players actually become undead creatures.
Did you say Metropolis?
No, Necropolis.
Oh, I was going to say Superman?
No, it ain't like that. But yeah, where depending on the character's class, they would turn into a certain type of undead. It's actually a very interesting adventure, per se. Yeah.
Well, don't forget, we also have one already built in as far as AD&D is concerned against undead. You know, weapons is the Mace of Disruption.
Yes.
I mean, again, if you just read that description of that weapon, that thing is nasty.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is fun taking different folklore and myths and legends and throwing it into your game and watching your players go, oh, I thought this worked. And they're like, no. Trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
Like, take the Buffy, the Vampire Slayer, go back to that, take that mythos, or the Supernatural TV show, take that mythos out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's all different in both those, compared one to the other.
Right.
And have the players try to figure that out. That's a lot.
Yep.
Right. Or what if the creatures, they behaved and shambled around like zombies, but they were actually still living? They're actually like living people, like how Walking Dead, there are people that were turned into zombies and they're dead. What if they were turned into zombies, but they were still living and you had to find a way to cure them?
Oh, that's a rough one. That's a very interesting concept.
There's something like that in the novel World War Z, where they had people where they basically went crazy and they thought they became like zombies. But they weren't the actual zombies affected by the virus. And that's they're actual living people who thought, well, better to, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. They became quote unquote zombies themselves. They were still living people. They were just trying to live amongst the horde of zombies, or they were acting like zombies.
And that's a moral dilemma too. What about the people that are affected by viruses that be cured? Do you go out and just instantly go kill them?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Remember, like in the show The Walking Dead, or in the comic series, remember what happened when they opened the barn?
Yeah.
Who did they fly in there?
Sophia, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, literally under the noses was Sophia. She wasn't lost at all.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that's a big moral dilemma. I mean, what do you do? Do you go ahead and put her down, or...
I know what you do, Nick. You cut out half that season and just find her in the first episode.
Yeah, pretty much.
They didn't have to drag. They dragged that out way too long.
They did.
But yeah, like that's just a little. And the movie 28 weeks later, 28 days later, whatever, the whole dilemma of killing all those people in that virus.
Yeah.
Can't just kill someone, you know?
Right.
No?
Like Jason's.
Oh, man.
It was right. What?
You can't just kill someone.
No, you got to have a reason.
So right. Now we go back to Jason now, who threw the book at Nick. I mean, at Will.
No, I still don't have. I still don't have one.
But yeah, actually, just going back though to that, the living zombie—that's actually part of Haitian voodoo, because zombie in the voodoo is actually just the loss of free will.
The movie Serpent in the Rainbow. See that?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Great take on the whole
Lisa Bonet.
Haitian zombie.
Yeah.
Lisa Bonet.
Lisa Bonet is a zombie?
I'm sorry. All I can say for the rest of the show now is Lisa Bonet.
Okay, then.
You mentioned the movie. Now I'm Lisa Bonet.
Okay.
Okay.
That's my answer to everything at this point, now that you've reminded me of that movie.
Taco.
Lisa Bonet.
Taco.
Lisa Bonet.
Taco.
Lisa Bonet.
Taco.
Hey, Vince?
Yes.
I just wanted to bring up that subject on what you was talking about, those zombies that actually look like living people.
Yes.
In this book here, they actually have a supernatural ability called face graft. They have the ability to take on the appearance of anyone whom they have previously slain.
Face graft. Was that the movie with John Travolta and Nicolas Cage?
Oh, face off.
Face off. Okay, sorry.
So they have a doppelganger ability, is what you're saying.
Well, but the problem with this, though, it has a drawback that the skin graft is that the skin eventually rots from the creature's body. What it basically does is it cuts off the face of the victim that it just ate or killed. It has to put it on its face, and it enacts a supernatural ability. But though the drawback is that the skin actually rots off, so they have to kill someone very quickly. Otherwise, they'll be revealed for who they are.
Oh, I like it, though. That's really good.
That is interesting.
Yeah. I like that a lot.
See what happens when sword and sorcery takes things over?
Good stuff. It's really good stuff.
All the people at White Wolf, they're maybe people think they're not all there, but, you know, they're there.
I don't know. They throw a good party. I've been the one at Gen Con.
Yeah.
Oh, they do throw a good party, yeah. Especially the masquerade balls are good.
Yeah.
So anyway, I guess that's going to complete Dragon's Horde.
Yeah.
And I guess that's going to come to the end of the show.
Aww.
Well, brains.
This is the 100th episode. We could basically talk about whatever you want at this point. It's the end of the show. I mean,
we talk about Lisa Bonet eating tacos. What?
Sure. I guess nobody has anything to talk about, huh?
I got nothing.
Yeah. Who's going to Gen Con next year?
I'll be there.
Yes.
I'm going to try.
I already have my hotel room booked, so I'm good to go.
It's the way to do it.
I know I'm going to Origins.
Cool. And I'll probably be going to Origins again as well. So
I got the Omni booked for this year at Gen Con.
Yeah, I have a suite at the Hilton. Yes, I have a suite at the Hilton. It rooms 6 and makes things really cheap because it's not that much more than a regular room.
Oh, you're going to have 5 roommates is what you're saying?
I'll have 5 roommates, so.
Yes.
It's actually not that bad because I have 5 people in my game group. So, we just go. We already had our little cabin con, so we can actually tolerate each other for several days in a row, so.
That's good. I can usually handle up to, as far as roommates go, up to about 0.
Yeah.
How was the crowd and the new hotels were in last year? Was it any more? Did it seem more spacious, or was it just the same?
It felt like there was less people at Gen Con, even though there were 6,000 more.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah,
that new hotel kind of messes it up. I gotta say.
Yeah,
it's too far away. It's a nice enough place, but it doesn't feel connected to the rest of the
right.
Of the
it's kind of an island to itself because that end of the convention center just really isn't used for all that much. It's like True Dungeon, and
that's it.
I was staying at the Homewood Suites this year, which I'll never do that again during MotoGP.
Wait, where is the Homewood? Is that out by the airport or something?
No, it's right on Meridian.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So all the motorcycles were lined up in front of my hotel, revving their engines till about 2 in the morning.
Awesome.
Yeah, they basically blocked off Meridian from...
What's the problem with that? I mean, come on, you're at a convention.
I was on the 3rd floor. My windows were rattling.
Yeah, but you're up till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning at a con anyway, so what's the problem?
They also had to have 7 cops in the lobby of my hotel.
Did your windows open?
No, fortunately.
No, it's bad because you could have opened them and been pouring things on the bikes.
Yeah. Oh, well, we did have a nice view. We got to see a guy get hit by a motorcycle. We got to see someone vomit in the street.
Cool.
We had 7 cops at one point in our lobby just making sure people that were staying at the room weren't there. So you had to actually basically pass Checkpoint Charlie to get into the hotel.
I'm still trying to figure out how this is any different than any other gaming convention I've been to.
Basically,
I don't recall the motorcycles.
They were all on Meridian Friday and Saturday night from the circle,
yep,
down to South Street. That entire street was just blocked. So, and it was just nothing but constant revving. They had a party as well in one of the parking lots. Those motorcycles were just basically doing laps. So we were literally told, cross the street at your own risk.
Nice.
Well, last time I went to Gen Con, I had the unlucky fortune of having the same floor as a band that was staying there. So all night they sang in the hallway.
Are you talking like an a cappella group? Like what's his name on The Office?
Yeah, kind of like that.
Nice.
Yeah.
All night long, they just in the hallway.
The treble tones.
Yeah, they were just yes, they were just singing in the hallway all night long. I was like, oh, go to sleep. And I love the drunk people that bang on doors in the middle of the night, thinking it's their room.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Nick, go to your own room, okay?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think for this Gen Con, I think I'm gonna get an apartment or a house rather than staying in a hotel for exactly all those reasons.
Yeah.
You know, just even if I have to be, you know, a few blocks away, having an actual home to stay in as opposed to a hotel might be the better way to be.
Yeah. Well, I found a good hotel that's maybe 3 or 4 blocks away, the Comfort Inn, and there was like no gamers there whatsoever, so it was great.
Yeah, because that's just a few blocks south of a Lucas Oil.
Yeah. You could still walk to the convention center if you really want to, but they have a taxi service.
Yeah, it's probably a good 15-minute walk since they moved everything to the other side of the convention center.
Oh, okay. So there, yeah.
Yeah, because I used to park there for like $5 when Gen Con first went to Indianapolis because there was a parking lot there. And it was like $5 parking, so I'm like, I shall park here. And when the exhibit hall was on the side of the convention center near the JW Marriott, it wasn't bad. It was like walking from one of the hotels 2 blocks east of the convention center. But now that it's on the other side, that's a nice little trek, especially if you're hauling stuff.
They moved the exhibition hall across?
Right. It's now off Capitol Street, basically where the RCA Dome used to be. Yeah, that is where the exhibit hall is.
Is it because of more room they needed?
Or? Yeah, it's bigger.
But yeah. They need more than the 2 football fields to do it? Jesus.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that's like the new end of the convention center, and that's where a lot of the Gen Con stuff is now focused. And also with the new layout, I never go up to the upper levels anymore since they've expanded the bottom of the convention center. So the part of the convention center where you'd go down, and it was like the Indianapolis Colts, like, party room or something that was connected to Lucas Oil, that's now all exhibit hall space.
Oh. So, where did they put Wizards? I know they had them on the second floor at one.
They were across from the exhibit hall.
Oh, they moved them there now. Okay.
Yeah, they were not up in Sagamore on the second level. So since I wasn't staying through a Skywalk hotel, I never even went up to the second floor. So I have no idea what was even up there this year. They actually consolidated a lot of stuff. It was Wizards, the auction, everything was confined to that one new hallway that you never, unless you had some event elsewhere, you never really had to leave that area.
Hmm.
So, I don't know.
One.
Yep.
Did you sit in on the D&D update?
No, at that point in time, me and my roommates, we were looking for a liquor store.
Was it D&D update?
The keynote.
Keynote speech.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
About what they said about 5th edition and D&D Next and where they're going with it and everything.
Right, bringing back all the old product in one way or another and all that stuff. Nope. when that was going on, we needed to make a run to cons, spirits, and liquor.
Nice.
Yeah.
The most important part of the thing, and Matt missed it.
Yeah.
No, he didn't. He went out and got booze. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, because I think because the first night we were there, we went there on Wednesday. We didn't go to bed till 5:30 in the morning, and the con hadn't started.
Yes.
And then we got up at 8:30.
What I love is the con is even started in the tunnel smell.
Yeah, that happened too. Well, Indianapolis is a interesting town because they have their sewer and their rain runoff water go through the same system.
And they don't believe in deodorant.
Yeah. I still like the fact that you can just get the nice steam coming out from the sewer system where you just see the stench coming up. So I'm like, so the city has a stench to it even without the gamers.
Really?
Yeah.
But it must have been nice with all that construction done.
Oh, yeah. That Georgia Street is actually really nice. They actually lined up tons of food trucks.
Cool.
On Georgia, because they actually have a center median now with, like, tables and chairs. So you can just sit there, and it's like a little park area almost in the middle of the street.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. They did a really good job, which is reviving that area. Now it's just a matter of what they're going to do with the Pan Am Plaza. Because that thing is just a mess and just disrepair.
So, Jason, have you been following the Dungeons & Dragons Next or the 5th edition updates at all?
Yeah, I've been actually playtesting it a bit, and so far so good. I mean, it's really hard for me to tell exactly where they're going with all of this. And I think it's the same for everybody. They seem to be trying to have kind of a little best of everything. You know, there doesn't seem to be a clear vision for where things need to go. I mean, at this point, honestly, I feel they're foundering a little bit. They're not seeing a lot of profit out of D&D the way they are out of things like Magic, and they're trying, and they've tried different things. You know, they've tried to turn it into a more perpetual income stream, and it hasn't worked so much in the past. So this I kind of see as their make it or break it opportunity. You know, if they figure out how to build a proper business model out of things this time, then I think we're going to see a real resurgence in why D&D matters to people. But there's also, I'd say, a good chance that this could be the last edition you ever see.
Well, they could possibly sell it off as well. I mean, Hasbro would do that, I would think.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. I mean, I think this is where they have to show, never mind whether the game's good or not. I mean, that's a whole nother issue. But and I do think that the 5th edition plays reasonably well. But what can they make any money with it is the real question. Can they make enough money for it to be worthwhile? And we'll have to wait and see.
It's all speculation at this point, I guess.
Right.
I'm speculating.
Right. Especially considering the stance they're taking now is they're doing all this public play testing and they're going to keep play testing it until it's done. There's no time frame on when it'll be released. So
yeah, to me, it's very much like we don't really know what this needs to be. We don't love this the way we should, and we're going to just sort of punt and say, "What do you guys want it to be?"
Right. The problem they could run into is by trying to appeal to all these various gamer sets, you end up with a bland system that appeals to. It has a little of everything, a lot of nothing, and it appeals to no one.
I kind of feel like it's where it's headed right now. Yeah.
Right. I mean.
Which ones are they going to pick for, like, the RPGA? Is what I'm wondering. What's going to be the standard?
Well, I mean, you could look at it for when they – what books – all they would do is say you can use these books and these option sets, because I think the option sets will probably be more like second edition in that they'll actually be their own standalone books. So if you want to add, like, this the skills and powers to the game – you would buy a separate book. So not only would the game be module, the books would also be separate. So they could just say, it's just whatever's in the core book, that's it. Or this book with this option book. I could see them going that route.
They're going to have a basic skeleton book and then say you have to buy this book if you want to do this. Or that
right. Book. That way you – I could see them going that route, but then you run into the 4th edition book model.
The 3.5 book model.
Right.
Or the second edition book model.
Right. Because I could see if they throw in all those options in the base books, then everyone will just treat it. They're not optional. It's in the base book.
Unless they put in a big, bold section that says optional rules.
They did that in the second edition player's handbook.
They did? I don't really know.
Yeah. There's like the weapon proficiencies, I believe. Or non-weapon proficiencies. Optional. Everyone plays with them.
Because the problem they're facing right now is that, I mean, I'm not privy to sales numbers inside, obviously, of Wizards or Paizo, so I don't know. But if I go by, I have friends who work at different conventions, and certainly at a couple of the bigger conventions out here, like Kineticon, you know, is one of the big ones. It's got, I think, about 15,000 people go to that.
Yeah.
And they're seeing a lot more Pathfinder than D&D games going on, and just Pathfinder is being very vibrant, and it's alive, and all these things are going on, and the D&D, they're seeing this decline in relative terms, and in like actually less people are playing D&D than Pathfinder now.
Right.
I think the thing is that Paizo is committed to Pathfinder. They obviously, this is what they live for this. They love this. And I just wonder if there's not sort of a passion gap here.
Right. And
I think it's just Lisa Stevens, and she sold us the devil.
This is what the deal is here with Paizo. What Paizo did was, and this, they have mentioned this before and everything. Lisa Stevens even talks about it. The money's not on the Pathfinder game itself. Their money right now is in the adventure paths. Their adventure paths is what's selling the game, and that's what's killing D&D. I think that they're gambling that Greenwood and all of them are going to revivify the love for D&D with the Forgotten Realms being redone again. I think that's what they're hoping that they're gambling on, and I feel bad for them because I don't think it's going to work for them.
Right.
I agree with Jason, though. The sentiment is this. I believe this is their last best shot at trying to get a chunk of the market. And just to let you know, Jason, that Pathfinder is the only company that has ever knocked off D&D off its number one sales in its entire history.
Yeah, it has, yeah.
Paizo is the only company that's ever done that.
Yeah.
That says a lot. I mean, because Paizo, as a company, is way smaller than Wizards. I mean, by orders of magnitude. Yet, look what they're managing to do.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're a powerhouse. And you know what, though? I think it was a very serious mistake to wait to announce that it's going to – when did they say it? 2014 or 2013?
They said 2 years for the game.
So, yes, 2014 would be the 40th anniversary of the creation of D&D as it is, and they just gave Paizo a big heads up. I think that was a very serious mistake.
Yeah.
You don't tell your competition we're going to release your next new game.
Right. So that's
what you're really doing there is you're telling everybody, don't get too committed to what's available now. Wait for the next one.
Right.
That was a mistake.
Right. Yeah. You're eating into your current sales.
Right.
Yes, well, they have those sales now because they're not making no books, so everything's done now.
Right, yeah, they're not releasing new 4th edition product anymore. All the new product they're releasing is actually reprints. Yeah.
That's all.
They're hoping to bank some cash off all the reprints now.
Well, I tell you, I'm telling you right now, the 3.5 sales have sucked here at the game store. They have not sold.
I think the reason they did that was trying to tackle the Pathfinder people saying, oh, we love 3.5 and Pathfinder's as close as we can get.
But the problem is they waited too long.
They waited too long.
And just the transition to 4th appealed to a completely different type of game player. 4th edition brought the Magic, the Gathering player into role playing.
Jason said it, the video game genre.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't mean that in a negative way. What I mean is that you genuinely have two different core influences for the two different types of gaming. That's all it is.
Right.
That's the reality of the situation.
Right, because the Magic the Gathering player really enjoys the min-maxing, the being hyper-efficient with limited resources. That is 4th edition.
4th edition, like at the Reaper mini store near me, the guy told me, he said they don't really sell 4th edition, but he said he likes it for one reason. It's a good way to bring new people into the game.
See, I don't understand when people say that. I understand if you say, for example, like D&D encounters. Is it encounters or essentials? Which is the one?
It's encounters.
There's both.
Yeah.
Essentials and encounters, yeah.
Well, whichever is the one where you can really just kind of sit down and go through a very pre-planned thing. I've actually DM'd those before you know, somebody asked me to step in at a game store when their regular DM wasn't there, and it only took me, you know, like 30 minutes to get ready for it. It was really easy to get into.
Right.
Yeah. I get how that's an introduction. But actually using 4th edition as an introduction, it's no less complex.
He was saying that it's very simple to just convey the rules to people and get them to start playing the game, and then once they're used to it, rip them out of that into something more complicated.
Huh. That's interesting, because I just don't see how that's easier.
I can't see that either, because what's my next question is this game still being supported by the company? And the honest answer is no, it's not. So I don't see why anyone in their right mind would, you know, spend all this money on a game that's soon to be, well, it's now out of print, basically.
Well,
when a new game company's coming, when new stuff's coming
out. Well, here's the thing, though, with that. Why do we still buy first edition stuff? Because we like that edition. If you like fourth edition, you're going to spend money on it. It doesn't have to be in print to be worth your money. And,
well, no, that's not what I'm saying. You have to have players, though. And if you don't have players, you're wasting time.
Right.
You're spinning your wheels.
Right. Out of print doesn't equal lack of players. Those are two different things. Unfortunately, for a lot of gamers, however, it has to be in print. Otherwise, they won't play it for whatever reason.
Well, I think the difference is that, you know, with Pathfinder, you've got a very vibrant living community right now, and they know that there's a future for the game. And with first edition, you've got still a pretty strong community, because first edition was in print for so long, it built up such a following. And even when it went to second edition, it wasn't really necessarily different people playing. It was still kind of an evolution. Right. Whereas fourth edition has not been around that long. It hasn't had a chance to build the same level of cult following.
Fourth edition was out 3.5 years before they did the first Friends and Family playtest for Dungeons & Dragons.
They just messed it all up.
That's not very long. I mean, first edition, if you go from the publication of the Monster Manual up through the time that they officially switched over to second edition, that's almost a decade.
Right. And then second edition was like
A decade.
Yeah. It's over a decade. 1977 all the way up to 1989?
Over a decade.
Yeah, 89. It was like second edition came out like 88, 89 and was around till 2000. 11 years. So it had longer time to build a community. And
you've got 20 years of old school gaming versus 3 or 4 of fourth edition.
Right. And then even with 3.0 and 3.5, it had 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and even more if you consider Pathfinder 3.5, which isn't so unfair.
Right.
Yeah. So we'll see how they do with this. I actually hope that they do well. It'd be very nice to see D&D return to being D&D so that you could actually make some connection between the games and not just in the name only. I really hope that it does well. This is probably their last shot.
Yeah, this is their last shot. I don't see them going anywhere after this, and Hasbro will probably see the lack of funding coming in and say, nope, get rid of it.
Well, here's the thing, though. The IP still has value in the publishing, the book novel. So will they see keeping the RPG alive in some form as a necessary evil to keep the IP going for the book lines, for the video games?
They're still spending money on Avalon Hill.
Right.
I don't see Hasbro doing it. I see Hasbro cutting the loss.
Well, it's like Time Warner. In Time Warner, they consider DC Comics, they keep the comic books around because they consider that an IP creation division.
You're right. You're right.
So maybe Wizards of the Coast will see the RPG Dungeons & Dragons as an IP creation department. So you make the RPG stuff so we can write books, so we can make video games, so we can do movies or television shows, cartoons, whatever. And at which point it'll still be around. It won't get the same love and funding that it would if it wasn't strictly there just to create new content to be used elsewhere, but it'll still be around. And then plus also there's something with like their contract with Atari, I think it goes through like 2014.
It's over. No, it's over.
Oh, it's over? Okay.
Yeah.
There's already a new company looking to make a new online D&D game as we speak.
Yeah, because they're the Neverwinter is the new online MMO they're working on.
Yes. I tried to sign up for the beta test, and they're not even available yet.
Right. It was funny. 2 years ago, we first heard rumblings about it, and this was when they were going to do the big Neverwinter push at Gen Con. They were releasing the Neverwinter book for 4th edition. They had all the novels. This is when they decided to focus everything once a year on a setting. And I got to interview the brand marketing director for Dungeons & Dragons there. And she had nothing at all to say about that MMO, even though it was Neverwinter and tied into everything else they were pushing. And it was scheduled for a release that year. And it kept getting pushed back. So I wonder about that, considering it's about 2 years too late.
I don't. Yeah. What happened? They had that whole thing with the spell scar and everything. What happened with that too?
You mean the spell plague?
Yeah, the spell plague.
Oh, they're fixing that. They're undoing all of that.
They're undoing everything. Everything is being redone. That's what I'm saying. I think they're betting on Ed Greenwood to revivify the Forgotten Realms and the D&D line by fixing up, putting everything back on track again before it all went downhill from 4th edition. 4th edition destroyed Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, they really, big time. A lot of people were disappointed in that. Me being one of them as well. But what are you going to do? All right, I think we've bored people enough. Anyone have anything else you want to say, or we'll head to the road?
No, I'm good to go. It was a pleasure speaking to you, Jason. Hopefully we'll hear from you again soon enough.
Nice to meet you and do our first show together.
Oh, it's awesome.
Yes, Jason, we'd like to see you come back once in a while and poke your head in and tell us your 2 cents.
I will be back every 100 episodes to let you know if Wizards is still alive.
Oh, I meant to say, I like watching your little videos and everything.
Oh, no. What did I do?
The view you?
View you?
Oh.
Do you still do the VU?
I haven't looked at it in a year and a half.
Oh, all right. You might want to go on there, because I know a couple of other people are still doing it that started it with you.
Right on. Good for them.
So that's been the podcast, the Roll for Initiative podcast, issue 100. Nick had to drop out. He had to go. He said, I guess he had to go deal with his family or something. Probably dinner time around his time right now. Anyway, I guess we'll do as you say, keep it original, keep it old school. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
See y'all later. Bye. Roll for initiative.